At the beginning of every podcast, there is a short segment where something funny is said. This is a placeholder for that segment in the podcast known as...
Trapped Under Plastic, the podcast to watch sophisticated artists say pee-pee, poo-poo, and doo-dee, doo-doo, unironically. Thank you, Clay Williams, for that lovely artistic intro.
Yeah, also, if I was smart, I would have read that. I would have integrated some one of those words in my fun little intro.
Yes.
And then it would have just... transition perfectly.
God dang it. Next time, one day
we'll be good at this.
Next time. All right, getting straight into the preamble ramble. John, as per usual, has 17 topics, and I have one, so maybe you should go first.
What did I write?
Sculpting versus painting, the point of no return.
Okay, so 'tis the season. Usually when the first snowflakes start to fall.
They have fallen.
And they have fallen here in the state of Minnesota. Yeah. Vincey V and I reconnoiter our relationship, and we start doing regular hangouts, and we do Discord video hangouts while we're hobbying.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually like an hour, 45 minutes, 2 hours.
They get naked.
You know? Yeah, that's why the video. Sweaty. That's why the video is on. Of course. And I was working on the sculpting stuff for my Golden Demon piece, and... I had this revelation, and then Vince and I talked it through, and he confirmed my suspicions, which is always good if you have a Vince nearby to confirm a thought that you have.
A Vince, so that's like multiple of them? Is he like a Pokemon? You can catch him?
Yeah, you can have your own Vince. He could be named something else.
Sure.
But, so Vince confirmed this. So, the difference between painting... And I'll label it as sculpting, but it's more of like a creating, whether it's creating a scene, could be a intricate base, could be a scene for a diorama, could be something like major kitbashing, you know, or sculpting a miniature. The major difference is in painting, there is very rarely, if ever, the point of no return where you can't go tweak things because they didn't turn out how you wanted to. Or you say, this blend isn't as good, or this color doesn't work, or the light attention needs to be more up here, the knee shouldn't be so bright. You can always fix that. Okay, so there's not really a point of no return there. But in the project that I'm working on for my Golden Demon piece, I did so much sketching, so much planning, so much moving shit around in Photoshop with the help of Willy Hanna, so much focus on lighting, so much figuring out exact placements, exact poses, exact turning of heads of models. But at a certain point, you have to do the thing that you can't undo. Now, that's not to say it is 100% not able to be undone. So once I place down this bits of rubble or this dirt or sand grit texture paste, or I set the levels with Milliput or whatever, I could go in there with the grinder and I could grind back out that Milliput. Mm-hmm. Sure. You can do that, but it becomes like this massive heavy lift that also has a snowball of effect of like what other things is it implementing. And I got to that point where it really trying to nail composition in this piece, I realized like even if I had it exactly where I wanted it, exactly what I wanted it to look like when you get to execution, there's too many variables. It just doesn't all line up perfectly. And you get as very close as you can. You find how much, if something isn't exactly right, how much hoops are you willing to jump through for that 3% angle change on one figure doing one thing? Or when you finally glued down the head on the model so he's looking exactly this way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not exactly right. Is it close enough? Is it not?
Yeah.
So I never realized how much more stressful that part is than with this project.
Yeah, some people assemble plastic models intentionally with super glue so they can take them apart later on, which never made sense to me for like the wargaming hobbyists, because I feel like especially those people want to just like set it and forget it. And it's like, why not use plastic glue for its extra strength? But yeah, if you did a competition piece in plastic glue and say you wanted to change the angle of the head to make it point like more camera center, you're going to damage that model like unrepairably and you're going to need to fix it, which then opens the door for liability, like repairing it poorly, right?
Yep.
So I'm curious, did you assemble the models with super glue or no? As like a insurance measure?
Good question. So I did everything with a plastic cement with sprue goo to have the smoothest transitions. However, I did not put the heads on any of the models. Mm-hmm. I also didn't put any of the shields on any of the models. And I built them and did some slight alterations to poses of the bodies based on how I wanted their posture to be. And then I can move them so they're more open to the scene and more closed, so there's differentiation. Once I got the scene all set up exactly how I wanted it, I then plastic cement glued on the heads so they'd be right at the angle right then and there. When I had all the scene set up, this is exactly where I want each head to be looking. Because at a certain point, you have to do that, I guess, unless you're going to paint the head on a little paper clip separate, which I just never have done.
You never do that?
No, I never do that.
Okay.
I mean, I see the value in it. I have done it. Like, I did it for teaching classes when I did the TMX Expo. Mm-hmm. I did the face painting class.
Yeah.
Those were all separate. But it, I don't, as long as it's not too obscured, I haven't really felt the need for that. And then there's the dude on a horse. I have that dude, the rider's completely separate. So I can pull him off, so I'll paint him separate. And I actually have the whole head of the horse. It kind of chops right at the neck where there's like a bridle thing, so it's a clean line, so you're not gonna have to gap fill that. I have the head that of a horse that I can pull off, mostly because I was kind of nervous of whether or not I could pull the rider on and off with the horse head still attached, so that might be glued on. But yeah, that's what I did. I just figured at a certain point, like, you have to. I was hemming and hawing on this shit for like, I've been working on this for like 4 full work days, and this is after having done all the composition work, all the sketches, all the reworks before I ever built anything. Mm-hmm. And then I went through the full extent of setting the whole thing up, cut out all these like cork steps that were different areas were cut off. So I'd have elevation changes that were all cut in circles to the size of the plinth. And then that I could do like a rough in of where each figure would stand and how it would look in full 3 dimensions as opposed to on paper. And the plinth was too big. Oof. I realized they were too spread apart, and it was not by a ton, but it was enough to where like I notice it, like each figure could stick their, if they were real boys and they stuck their arms out, they could touch each other. If everyone's arms are out, they could touch each other's arms, but not by a lot. So they just feel, so I went through all of that work and I scrapped it. And the whole purpose of that was that plinth was a wood plinth that I could use on my disc sander to have perfectly smooth all the way around. Mm. The smaller size is a resin one from Tarot Model Maker. Mm-hmm. And I was scared as shit to put that to the sander. Am I going to be able to bring it back?
Oh, for sure you'll be able to.
Do you have a
grinding wheel?
Yes.
Yeah, a little bit of wax, a little buff on that at the very end after sanding, you'll kill that thing.
This whole wax period, I've done it over the course of 2 days, and I still have this afternoon when I go back to the final step. But yes, you're right.
Or sorry, not a a grinder, not an angle grinder. The stationary one with a big, yes, has a big buffing wheel attachment. Okay. The reversing in time a little bit to the head discussion.
Yes.
I generally don't mind doing that with GW models because they snap into their slot like so nicely. And so what that means for me is once I have a fully painted head, I don't got to fuck with it so much to get it to fit into where it's supposed to fit into.
True.
Because modern GW kits are kind of like Legos. It kind of just drops in.
Yeah.
So I feel especially okay painting them by themselves. And I like to be able to hold a head and completely go horizontal with it and then sneak my brush up like under noses, under cheeks, under chins, like and like get like in like eyes and tear duct areas. And if there's like features in the way preventing me from getting fully horizontal, true, then it kind of is a little bit annoying. But also, the best part about having a head on a piece of cork is that all of my fingertips and all of my control get to be right by that head. So everything's like, I'm not an inch away, I'm not a half an inch away, I'm like fucking millimeters away. So I'm just like fully locked in. But yeah, I mean, you don't need to do that.
Yeah, it probably is the better thing, especially if I'm doing like a single model or a competition piece that is for like a duel or something like that. It's like I get a level of overwhelmed as I'm working on a project like this, because then I like look and think of everything all at once, and then I'm just like kind of get overwhelmed and I'm like, I ain't got time for that. I just gotta get to work. But you're right. But luckily, one of the figures, he's kind of one of those, it's the kind of guy that looks like a young boy. He's got a head in a box. That guy's like it's not a snap fit piece, but he's one of those where his head isn't separate. It's like part of his chest and everything. So I'm not going to cut that off.
No.
But he's also very open. Like, you can get all the way around his head because there's nothing close. Same with the dude on the horse. Like, he's just kind of sitting up and he doesn't have the problems you have is if dudes with arms and shit in the way, you know, that's where things can get real hairy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but
what was in a box? What's in the box?
The head's in the box.
Okay.
It's
not a dick in a box.
It's Brad Pitt's wife. Her head.
Two different references.
Oh, it's not a dick in a box.
Dick in a box and you went seven.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, that'd be sweet if I like re-sculpted that head in the box to look like Gwyneth Paltrow's face.
Oh my god, I don't know if sweet's the right word. Imagine in seven, he's like, "What's in the box?" And it's a dick.
It's just like a big floppy pink dildo, and he pulls it out, and he's like, ah,
ah, ah. And he has the same reaction. He's like just crying. Yeah, that's awesome.
No.
So I was browsing the good old YouTubes, and I got a video recommended to me that had about 2,000 views. It had Mr. Beast's face in the thumbnail, and it was some gaming video about board games. And I'm like, surely this video is just putting Mr. Beast's face in the thumbnail because they just want to get more views. Because like it had 2,000 views. It was really low. And so I clicked on it and I watched it. And Mr. Beast loves the board game and potentially other ones called Dune Imperium, which is a really fucking good game. I've played it twice. And he loves it so much that he reached out to this YouTube channel or an organization to create an invite-only Dune Imperium tournament that he played in and that he was a finalist in was at the final table of four remaining players, because you can play four players in Dune Imperium. And so he was at the final table. He competed all the way until the end. So not only is he interested in it enough to like have an event run, but also he's got fucking gaming chops too.
Wow!
So like, what the fuck?
Is it like a high skill ceiling game that you've played it? So do you kind of see that?
It's a midweight Euro game, and so like there's no dice. There's very little randomness. There's card drawing and stuff like that. But yeah, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of resource controlling. There's combat in the game as well. They were playing an expansion of the game that I'm not totally sure how it's different. But I would say that board games, and maybe I'm wrong because I'm not super deep into that hobby. I'm pretty deep. I feel like board games are a little bit lower skill ceiling than miniature war games, but it's still like high enough to play in a tournament like enjoyably. And if there are, like, I don't know how people were in the tournament. I'm guessing it was, like, 60, 50, something like that.
Damn.
If he's getting at the – I don't know. That could be wrong. It could be 30. It could be 10. If he's getting to the end there, he's got to be pretty good, you know? Wow. But, like, that's crazy. Like, I keep finding out more things about this guy. I don't know how he has time to do all the stuff he does, but it was fun to find that out.
Well, how many employees does he have now? It's like they have teams that work.
For sure.
They have project teams that each team is, like, in charge of a different video, basically.
Yeah. But I also – He in an interview, said his work schedule. And he's like, basically, I just work nonstop until I'm burnt out. And then I take a day or two off, and then I do it again. And I'm just like, what the fuck?
Oh, yeah. Like that is his life, too.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't have a family. He doesn't have kids. He doesn't, like, you've seen the stuff where it's like his house is, like, he doesn't have a big fancy house or what.
Yeah, he does that intentionally. He doesn't necessarily care to have a big fancy house.
He spends all his money back into the channel.
Yeah. Yeah, anyways, that was cool to figure that out.
Wild. That's, yeah. I mean, I guess it doesn't surprise me because it takes a certain kind of personality to kind of do what he does that's so, like, intensely doing a thing as hard and as far as you could, like, past the point of comfortability from the normal person, which is part of the success of the channel is because it's just so
it's very big picture, right? Yeah. You can see big picture and then make small changes to move his channel in that direction, which is like all about like big board games are like. It's like, I have a goal. There are a million things I can do to get to that goal. I'm going to optimize the steps to get to that end goal. So I guess there's definitely some similarity there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a fun little side note.
I know. It was interesting.
I think I pulled in two of mine in that one, so we're going to...
Oh, did you?
We're going to do that. Because my next thing was like full ball sack pre-painting, which I kind of discussed there, was like how much I've really... like. And it's part of the premise. As of the recording of this podcast, I have not written the script for this next video, which is the building of my Golden Demon piece. And my bloodline for that video is I fucked up last year before I ever took my paintbrush out. I fucked up. I lost before I ever started the race. Is it that dramatic? I kind of think so. I kind of think, like, I'm really proud of the painting work that I did on that piece. But I just, like, it didn't make a strong piece when it was complete. The composition, I lost because of that, is my main thing.
Relatively speaking. Because it's only compared to the things that were there. And and even then, we're comparing pieces of art. So yeah. I wouldn't get too down on yourself. I think GD is a little bit more of a crapshoot than it seems, which is not to say that they're doing anything wrong. It's just difficult, you know, when you get to this high level of miniature painting to really figure out what's right and what's wrong and what's deserving of a gold and not deserving of a gold.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really nice piece. I don't think... Yeah.
I'm happy when I go by my display cases and I see it in there. It makes me happy.
Good.
I'm glad that I have it.
Good.
And, you know, there was a point where I was going to redo the whole base composition, take all the models off of that, and redo the piece.
Post Golden Demon.
Yeah, and I was going to enter it for this upcoming year's Golden Demon. Now, the plus side of that is I don't have to fucking paint the figures. But I decided that, like, there's a level of... at least to me personally, that's not healthy, that I need to let a thing live and let it be its own artifact in my history.
Totally.
And not try to change, but rather to learn from. And totally. So, and to take from that and to start anew. And that's what I've been doing here. And so I really have focused on, and I've really reached out to a lot of awesome people, our group of the Four Horsemen included, to figure out, like, ask for help, you know, and ask for advice and to not be too tied to any idea or decision that I make before I get too invested in it. Like, I try to keep this project at arm's reach until I really am happy with the composition. And I think I'm there. Am I 100% happy? No, but just like you're never going to be 100% happy with the final paint job. But I feel really strong about it. And so... I really was like, I need to invest a lot more time on the front end to set myself up for success. So that was kind of the, we'll see what happens with the video. And, you know, it's not a battle of Warlord Titans, but it is making a scene. It's making a much smaller scene.
Much smaller, more intentional
in
scene.
In Warhammer. But my last thing I wanted to talk about, because we just passed the Halloween season.
Mm-hmm.
Did you go trick-or-treating?
No, but I put some candy out for some kids.
Some ghouls and goblins?
Yes.
Are you a put a bowl on the steps person?
Yeah, just because of the two dogs, yep. Like, they just bark so much whenever someone rings the doorbell.
Yep.
And they still ring the doorbell when you put the bowl out there, but they do it much less, so that's the only reason why.
Okay. Yeah, that's cool, too. We did that, too. We put the bowl out because we kind of had a Halloween get together. It's kind of something that I've developed into tradition.
Yeah, I've heard. I've heard of these parties.
Yeah. Oh no, and it's not that party.
Oh, okay.
We didn't do that party. My wife,
Joshy's parents, and shit.
Yeah, we did. We did not do that this year. We went to a play, a local play at the theater, cool. And then we went out to eat, and then we just had some drinky poos downtown, and went home, called it a night. It was great. But on actual Halloween, I bring over, like, my brother, my sister-in-law, their three kids, our good friends that are neighbors, when they're two girls, and then my mom and dad. they all come over to our house, so then my parents get to see all the little kids in their costumes. And then I order a shitload of pizzas. And then my mom brought homemade taco dip. Mm. Oh, man, that was so good.
Seven-layer taco dip.
Yeah, and the sister-in-law made a giant chocolate and vanilla frosting cake. It's in the shape of a skull.
Okay.
It was great. And so then we all go trick-or-treating. My mom and dad stay at our house because it's balls cold this year.
Yeah, dude, it was not pleasant.
So we all go out in my neighborhood and go trick-or-treating, and they stay home. But we still put the bowl of candy out on the steps, mostly because if my massive dog decided he just wanted to go out and go trick-or-treating with the whatever kids come to our house, my parents couldn't stop him.
Right, yeah.
So, and he's...
Is he full grown now?
He'll be two on December 1st, so... Yeah, he's as tall as he's ever going to be, but he's going to continue to put on mass. Okay. Like, he's put on more mass in the last 6 months. He's probably put on 30 pounds.
Okay.
He's just like a thick sausage. He's not fat. He's just solid as a rock. But so we went trick-or-treating, and it was, as of that morning, there was like 3 inches of snow on the ground.
Yeah.
It was 31 degrees, and there was 30-mile-an-hour winds.
Okay, I don't remember the winds.
The winds were terrible that morning. By evening, we're kind of up on the hill and in the woods, so the trees caught a lot of it, but it was still cold as balls in the morning when I walked the dog. But by evening, the wind had died down, and by just like bundling up a bit and then just walking all over the place, it was great. It was great. We went to about where we have not a lot of houses up in our neighborhood, but we went to, I counted 16 houses is all. And my daughter filled up her candy bag 2 times in 16,
in 16 houses.
Yeah.
Everyone's super generous because you don't get a ton of kids. Is that why?
There's 3 groups of trick-or-treaters on our hill.
That's, and we're sick, one of them. Actually.
Yeah, it's wild. I expected in the 10-plus years that we've been there that, like, sooner or later the word would get out and you'd get the other people from other neighborhoods coming up to trick-or-treat in your neighborhood because they realize it's a big deal. Like, like, it's not that, like, there is a rich section like further up the hill where like newer houses that they're rich people built up there, but all these houses in my area are built in like the late 80s. They're nice, but they're not nothing fancy. But the people, like, if you just give one king size candy bar, like that's the bare minimum.
Seriously,
a lot of our neighbors, because they all know like my daughter and then the neighbors, their 2 girls, and they know like my brother's kids now too, because we're the only ones that go trick-or-treating. We've been doing it for like 6 years, and they know them, and so they make bags of candy. Each kid has their own bag of candy.
Oh, my gosh. It's like an Easter basket.
Yeah, it's the greatest. So then we get back home, and I get to go and look through. My daughter and I, everyone leaves. I'm like, get the fuck out of my house. I got to go look at the candy now. And we sit on her bed, and she pours it all out, and we spread it all out, and it just takes me back to when I was a kid.
Yeah, dude.
And then I'm like, it's time to pay the dad tax.
You steal some for the emergency stash?
Yeah, so it's like, well, we'll find out what things she doesn't like. You know,
she a Whopper hater?
No, she's not a Whopper hater. She is rightly a disliker of Mounds and Almond Joys, because what child likes Mounds and Almond Joys?
Yeah,
I also don't like those, so we're in a conundrum there. So it made me think, you know, like, what is there certain Halloween candies that really, like, is your favorite one? Is it the ones that you buy at the store when you get Halloween candies because you know you like them? Or you don't buy them because you know you'll eat them all?
Yeah, I feel like I'm a basic bitch and I like Snickers. But I'll say that I went to my friend's house this past weekend to watch the International, which is like a big video game tournament for Dota 2.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't a big prize pool this year. I don't know why, but it normally is like $20 million. Amber, my friend's wife, also named Amber, bought a ton of candy. I don't know why, but she did. And man, I've never eaten more candy bars in my life. And one that really shocked me was that Payday has a chocolatey Payday.
Oh, I've had this.
And they're fucking good.
Yeah, they are, dude.
And so I ate a bazillion chocolatey Paydays and a bazillion Take Five candy bars.
Take Five with that pretzel in there,
bud? Yeah, dude. And holy cow, those were amazing. So I would get up and go to the stash. I'd get a Payday, and I'd get a Take Five, and then I'd go sit down in my fucking chair, and I'd watch fucking Dota. And I'd get up every 10 minutes for 7 hours. And then I'd eaten 30 candy bars. And it was those two are really good, though.
Oh, that's a good call. I mean, I like when you get stuff like that that's not like your usual wheelhouse.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, we all love the peanut buddy cups.
Yeah, yeah.
You love the Snickers. You know, you'll eat the Kit Kats and the Twix. Yeah. You know, it's kind of tier two.
Yeah.
Second class citizens.
Totally.
But you eat them.
Yeah.
And, you know, like the mini Snickers in the freezer. Like, that's my...
You like frozen candy bars?
I do. I like frozen candy bars. Rolos, dude?
Yeah, they're pretty good. Well, you like... See, when you freeze caramel stuff, then it kind of gets chewy.
Yeah, I don't do Rolos in the freezer.
Okay.
I just thought of Rolos, so I said Rolos.
Okay, yeah.
Rolos are great. But yeah, when you get something like that that's not your usual thing, like, I don't got my way to buy Take Fives.
Yeah.
But then, you know, like once a year, once every 2 years, you have a Take Five, you're like, fuck, dude, this is great.
Yeah, dude.
You ever had the Reese's Sticks? They're like... a Kit Kat,
okay.
But they're Reese's and they're slightly bigger. They're more like those wafer things that come in the
Nutty Buddy things.
You know those like the wafers that come in like strawberry, chocolate, or vanilla.
Oh yeah, dude. Yeah. Do you like that?
No, they're not that good.
You don't like them? I love fucking wafery things.
Yeah, well, wafer cookie thingies. They're kind of like that, but they're like it's Reese's peanut butter between the wafers and then covered in chocolate, dude. Those things are money, man. I don't know if you can get those at Halloween candies. Final thing that I freaking love, and my daughter does too. So we had like we almost like had a duel to the death to get her Krabby Patties. You ever had the Krabby Patties, SpongeBob Krabby Patties?
It's a gummy thing.
Yeah, they're like a gummy burger.
I've had gummy burgers, but not a Krabby Patty one.
Yeah, dude, like Krabby Patties have taken over the gummy burger industry. Like the regular gummy burgers, not even available.
Seriously.
Yeah, Mr. Krab just like put them all out of business.
God
so,
damn.
Yeah, next time you go through the grocery store candy aisle, you'll find Krabby Patties, okay. And I implore you.
Okay. Are they good?
They're fucking amazing,
what?
Dude.
What?
They're amazing.
Does it taste better than normal gummy burgers?
100%.
What the fuck are they doing, dude? It's that secret recipe, bro.
Yeah, do you want to hear it?
Yeah,
I can explain it to you.
Please.
Okay, so here's why they're amazing. So each Krabby Patty consists of four parts.
This is an episode of SpongeBob.
Okay, you got the upper bun, the lower bun, the lettuce, and the burger.
What the pickle, dude?
Oh, yeah. Maybe it is a pickle.
You hiding them under your tongue, dude?
It's either the pickle or the lettuce. It's a green thing, and it's semi-translucent. It's the only semi-translucent gummy in the burger.
A little mysterious.
Okay, so here's why they're awesome. Each of the four pieces of a Krabby Patty have a different gummy consistency.
What?
Yes.
They did way more R&D than they needed to.
Oh, my God, yes. Like, there's the firm gummy, which is the pickle slash lettuce, whichever green thing is. There is the middle one, which is the burger, which is like the middle consistency. It's not as firm, but it's not super soft. And then the upper and lower bun are the softest, but they're different shapes. And the upper bun is more poofy.
They got the round and the flat.
Yeah. Dude, you just sit there and enjoy that one piece at a time.
You do?
Yeah.
Are you a psychopath that like will take an Oreo apart and eat it piece by piece?
No.
Okay.
No.
But the gummy Krabby Patties, though.
Yeah, like, what are you going to do? You lick out the frosting of an Oreo, then it's like you're just depressed as you eat
the
second half of the Oreo.
I'll never understand.
Just enjoy it all together.
Yeah.
You know? Well, that's the preamble.
Amazing.
Do you like Krabby Patties? You know, if they sold Lion Bars in America in the Halloween section, I would be in heaven because Lion Bars are probably my favorite candy bar on the planet. But it's Canada and the UK, I think, is where you get those.
Yeah, I think so. That came in our UK gift bag.
Let us know in the comments section what is an underrated Halloween candy that you enjoy, much like the Krabby Patty, because I am all for going to try new things.
Okay.
Especially if it's candy.
Maybe next time we do a candy tier list. No,
okay. One final note on this.
God.
I actively avoid the grocery store and Target for like 4 or 5 days after Halloween because I don't want to be enticed by clearance Halloween candy.
Okay.
Because they mark that shit down so much.
Yeah, dude.
If you're there like 1 to 3 days after Halloween, I mean, you could just eat candy for the next year and a half.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, like a whole bag is like 70 cents. And it used to be $13 the week before Halloween.
And you don't want that?
Well, I do want that. That's why I don't go there because I would buy it and I would eat it all.
Yeah.
So just word of the wise, this is your, you know.
You've been warned.
Been warned.
All right, on to what we painted. So I think I must have mentioned this before in the past, but me and Curtis are preparing for the recorded Kill Your Friends version of A Song of Ice and Fire. We're getting some practice in because he's using bulletins for the first time. And we're trying to figure out what a good list would be to fight against each other for both of our armies, Greyjoys and Boltons. And the first game we played, I gave him his best scenario that he could ever get, which is called Feast for Crows. And I ran the most anti-Bolton list I ever could as a Greyjoy player, just to see in a perfect world where both factions are like at max strength, like what's going to happen. And I fucking crushed him. And so then this time I stepped back a little bit and we did a different scenario, changed some things, and it was a super close game. This was last night. He won like 10-8.
Oh, that's
good. So we're getting a little closer now. That game would have been good to record. I think there was a lot of really cool moments in that one. And so we're trying to figure things out. And so in figuring things out, I'm trying out new commanders, trying out new attachments, new NCUs, non-combat units, and I'm painting up a bunch of one-off minis right now. So I painted Balon Greyjoy a second time. Fucker.
Because he was a victim of the spooge.
He was one of the victims of the spooge.
Spoogegate 2023.
Spoogegate. Then I also painted up Euron Greyjoy.
Oh, fucking Euron, buddy.
So Euron, I painted his face in that the new AP Fanatic paint line, which I'll talk about later in the extended portion of the podcast. But I also painted this guy like you painted your Tyranid model. I didn't go crazy with the undercoats. I did just one dark blue undercoat, and then I hided everything up from there. And
so good.
Yeah, it does. It's shockingly looks really good. So the one thing that I had the most struggle with was the cream color. Because going from dark navy blue to that color with like a thin paint was challenging without getting it looking a little bit kind of grainy and bad. But I eventually worked it up after a couple layers of translucent layering, and it looked fine. But his face is all Fanatic paints, and I want to talk to you more about that later in the extended portion of the episode, like your technique on that. So that was that guy. Really happy with the golden eye patch. That was Evan's idea.
Yeah.
I wanted to put gold higher up on the model because I wanted to paint the trim of his waistband gold and his axe thing gold. And I was like, I need more gold somewhere else. I want to put in, like, I want to paint some of these scales gold, but how do I paint it? Do I give him like the Star Trek, like, upper left breast patch, you know? Or do I give him like a stripe?
Yeah.
And then Malev was like, you should just paint them randomly. Like they've been broken and replaced. And I was like, that's fucking great.
It works, dude.
It does. So that, and then Evan was like, also the eye patch. I'm like, God damn. So stream came together.
Yeah.
For that gold, man.
Yeah. It's great because there's no pattern to the few gold ones.
Yes.
Because, you know, we want pattern. And so when it's obviously not a pattern, it works so much better.
Yeah. So that was Euron. It was pretty fun painting him.
This is a good model. Like, the pose is good.
It is.
There's the right amount of detail.
Yep.
You know, Grant, you know, it is Seamon plastic, although it's their newer plastic, so it's nicer. So there's the edges aren't as crisp as if it was a GW, but they're not bad.
No, like, they're not bad.
It's just, I also just think this figure looks fucking badass.
He does look badass, yeah.
You got the coolest boy here, and
he kind of lost the end of his nose a little bit, so
I saw that.
He looks a little like an undead person, right? Like he's missing his tip of his nose.
I mean, that's more than the tip. It's just most of his nose is gone.
He's got kind of a flat face, yeah.
But if you look at him straight on, you can't tell.
Yeah.
Because like the shape of the nose is there, and you kept some shadows on either side, which is important.
I tried to make like a regular nose, yeah. But yeah, pretty happy with him. I painted Balon over here, who I was unhappy with the first time I painted him, and I'm still kind of unhappy with him again. He's a fucking hard model to paint, man. His face is super challenging. Something about the combination of the details on his model, I'm just not like landing colors in the right spot. I don't like the cream color of like that top part of his like shirt or jerkin next to that teal.
Yeah,
it doesn't look good.
It looks great on the sleeve, though.
Yeah, yeah. So originally I painted that flipped up part right next to his white shirt a different color, brown leather, like the interior of his cloak was a different color. Yep. But that looked bad too. It kind of like subdivided the top half and the bottom half of the model.
What if you did it the dark blue that this guy's cloak is?
Well, I wonder if painting the rest of the cloak this dark blue and keeping the teal color there would be fine. So instead of a dark color, it was a light color that was like the border color?
I think the issue is the light undershirt right next to the light teal.
Yeah, so
that's the tough part. I really like the teal cloak everywhere else because you have the nice separation in the dark of his hair and the dark of the scabbard. It really outlines the cool parts of his chest really well. It's just that one part.
Yeah, So maybe even something as simple as just some more heavy recessed shading, like a dark line.
That's true.
I don't know.
Yeah, that could do it. Yeah, you just give a nice dark line separation in there.
Yeah.
Even use like that blue as your dark line.
Yeah, that or I could hit it with contrast paint. That's like Leviathan blue thinned out a little bit. Just see what that does.
Dupe it in.
His face was so hard to paint. He's looked so pouty right now. But man, that's like 10 attempts to like paint that mouth. Cause like it was so weird. I was painting the mouth and in one orientation, it looked fine. And then I would look at it on camera and what Stream saw, and he looked like a fucking idiot. He looked so stupid. And I was like, what is happening?
You are fighting a very subpar sculpt.
Dude, on this a model, yeah.
On a figure where the face is really an important part of the model.
He's so proud looking. Yeah.
His chin is up and like there's nothing around his neck. Like it's really drawing your eye up there.
Yeah.
And I can certainly tell that you did a lot of sculpting with paint here.
I tried, yeah. It was tough. Everything is so shallowly defined, if I can say that.
Yes.
And it's like you start to lose it after a couple layers of paint. And so you gotta pick your battles wisely when painting models like this. And yeah, I think I got to a point where I was like, I don't really know where the lips are anymore.
I think it looks great. Knowing how difficult this would be to paint.
Yeah, I painted them again, second time now, and both times were challenging. Yeah.
The way that I would have approached this head would not have worked for using it as a game model because I would have gone very atmospheric, very stark, where there's a lot of changes from like a bright right on his forehead in the upper cheek, and then it goes really dark. But that doesn't work for a game because then you'd have to continue that through the whole model, and that would be a totally different paint scheme.
Else. It might work though.
Yeah. I
for like a whole army if you did it like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I've never really seen that.
Yeah. I think it's possible. As long as like you've got to punch it to 11 for the areas that you're really drawing attention to.
Yeah, like the important parts, like the shape of the model, like lips, cheekbones, like chin, like maybe a little bit of forehead, bridge of the nose, like those things like make a face.
Yeah. And that just like that the parts of that scale mail that's really catching the light are really shiny and like just draws you in. The problem with doing that in a gaming mini is you have certain angles of holding the mini where it doesn't look good. And when you're on the table, you know, they kind of have to have, I don't want to say ideal angle to make the light work. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying there are certain parts that are naturally going to fall into a lot of shadow that just aren't as interesting to look at because you're not seeing the part that really is drawing your eye.
Yeah.
You know, like you as the commander, when you're seeing your dude's butts the whole game, it's going to be much more boring than your paint jobs are for this. So that's why.
Yeah. So to finish my army for this video, I'm going to Europe for a fucking full week. A lot of time away from the old paint desk. Well, I'll be painting in Europe. I'll be painting.
But you won't be painting Simon plastic.
No. Me and Roman are going to paint the Ghoul Queen from Mindwork Games, a model I bought a while ago. She reminds me of Bav Morda from Willow.
Bav Morda!
She's got big evil witch energy.
What's her name again? I want to look up the model.
Ghoul Queen.
Ghoul Queen. Maybe Blair can show a picture of her on the screen right now.
Yeah, that'd be cool. But yeah, so I'm going to be gone for like a week. I'm going to come back, and then I think I'm going to have 1 week to paint the rest of my Greyjoy army, which is not insane because I have a lot of characters painted. I have units painted. So I don't have that much more left to do, but it'll be a little bit of a mad dash to paint that army in that week to get it all finished up. But then if I do accomplish that, I'll have two painted armies.
Oh, man. Okay. This is the Braum, one of the Braum pieces. I have a history with that original artwork because that original art piece came out when I was a young, impressionable, nerdy teen.
That's cool.
Yeah, 14, 15 years of age. And it was featured in a magazine that I had a subscription to. It was a magic magazine called Inquest. And like whenever I see that picture, it just like takes me back. I remember that. And I remember like looking at that, thinking it was so cool. And Like that really, that piece particularly got me into Brahm and learning about all his stuff and finding pieces that he did because his art style is just so fucking awesome.
Wow.
So yeah, I'm really excited to see what you guys do with that.
I mean the just the concept with her eyes rolled into the back of her head.
Yeah.
That idea is so cool. But yeah, I'm excited too. I'm excited for what Roman wants to talk about. Like, he was the one that reached out to me and was like, hey, let's do a thing. I'm like, okay, sure, let's do a thing. So I don't know what the lesson's going to necessarily be about.
That's going to be so fun. I'm excited to have a full recap on Trapped Under Plastic.
Yeah, Monty Sansovino and that. Yeah, it's going to be a lot to talk about.
Oh, man. I fully expect, like, steel-hardened steel Conan Scott to come back to be like, I have decided... I am ready.
For what?
I don't know. That's what I'm excited about. I don't know what you're ready for. You're like, I am going to win something amazing with my painting.
I'm definitely going to bring a couple display models to throw into whatever category. I'm not sure what. I have to register those pieces. I forgot about that. Roman told me that. So I got to figure out which one of my display models are the best looking ones. Maybe the Duchess, probably the Ranger, maybe that fade model. There are some sussy parts on that paint job, though. So I had to pick a couple. Maybe the Chef Bust.
Yeah.
Or
Pizza Boy, too.
Or Pizza Boy.
I think Pizza Boy tells a really good, it's an artistic expression.
Yeah, which I think probably works best at MSS.
Yep. Yes, it does.
So, yeah, I'll have to figure out how to transport that shit. I don't have a great way of doing that yet. But yeah, I'll give that a shot.
Depending on how many it is, shoot, I wish we had this conversation prior. I could have brought up my case. You could have brought that.
Oh, yeah.
That one.
Because I can bring a suitcase and...
When I went to Nova, that was my... I took that as your extra item. Not your carry-on, but your little extra item.
Mm-hmm.
And that size case fits under the foot, your foot spot.
Okay.
So what I ended up doing is like when they all sit down and get on the plane, you put it under there. And then after they go do that check before they take off, I just set it on my lap. I was lucky enough on the way there was no one in the seat next to me, and I just put it in the seat next to me.
Did you seat belt it?
I did not. But like when we went through stuff, I found myself being like a mom in a car, like threw my arm over so I wouldn't move.
Yeah.
But you have the poster tack around the edges of the base and stuff. Shit ain't moving. But yeah, I found too, is like, oh, when I was on my lap, I could sit there and I just had like my phone out because, of course, you're on the ghetto small planes that don't have screens. So I could just sit there and watch something and my kind of arms are resting on top of it. So it wasn't uncomfortable.
Okay. Okay.
But if you end up needing something, you don't have anything else, you can certainly borrow it. It is an hour and 15-minute drive, but it depends. You might be able to wrap stuff up in bubble wrap. So maybe now let's talk about a little bit about what I painted. And then did you want to do a little preface on like this trip? Because I don't think the Goody Peepees have heard much about it yet. Maybe not. We'll do a whole discussion later. But did you want to chat about it just a little bit more?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. So what I painted was
half of a model.
I painted
fucking hack.
I painted the important part. Don't look from that angle. Other than if you look up at the puppy's face from that angle.
Oh, hello.
So this is a dwarf holding a pug puppy, and this is by Durgan Paint Forge, and this is a 3D sculpt. So I backed a Kickstarter. He's got a Kickstarter going on right now. I think it will still be going on when this episode goes live. It's a new one with a lot of orcs and stuff, but you can also get his back catalog. And he does something wonderful that more people are starting to do where you can back on Kickstarter to get the resin models that he will send to you, or you can buy packs of the STLs. I love his stuff. He's such a great sculptor, so much just personality in his pieces. And so I'm like, I'm going to back the STL file pack. And it was like 18, 20 models, and it cost me $40. And I'm like, geez, man, that's so great. And so this was one of them, and it was the point of the video was kind of like showcase when 3D printing, and the painting aspect of it was to show once you kind of get into the painting and you do something, if you got your printer dialed in, you kind of lose that this was a 3D print. Now, if you look really closely from some certain angles in the underside of the back, you might be able to see some little divots. So I didn't clean it 100% perfectly, but you can clean it so that all those divots are gone. And the pre-supports on these are solid. They're not great, but they're good. I mean, I didn't really have any problems with it. So I just did the same thing that you did with your Greyjoy guy here, where I did some under priming, warm from the front into his right, cool from below and back to his left. So we have a kind of a dual light scheme, and then just built off the warm side of the direction of the strong light of the interesting pose. Now, the tough part about painting this is actually in hindsight. And while I was painting this, I was talking to Vince. I'm like, this was not the right model to pick for this because you have two figures basically nose to nose that you can't, the angle light thing is very hard to pull off.
Yeah. Cause you have two angles you want to care about, right?
Yes. And so I realized that when I was like 5 hours into painting, I'm like, this was wrong, but it was still really fun. And it was a challenge I realized in the moment. And then I had to try to find a way to solve.
Sure.
And dude, I solve it correctly? Probably not, but I still wanted to have enough of that cool light pushed up and over exaggerated on the face of the puppy, because I think that's an important part. So the highlighting up and the cool tones on the puppy's face, which is supposed to almost be like a black, because a lot of the pugs have like a real dark fade to dark on their faces, and then to push up the highlights of that cool light. There's also not a lot of cool highlights done on the back that would then be there to make it more uniform.
Yeah. There's a cute little story built into this piece.
Mm-hmm.
His backpack has a hole chewed into it that has a piece of cheese falling out of it, and the pug has a piece of fabric in his mouth.
Yes.
That is so fucking cute. And he has a little toy. So this is his dog. Like, yes. Otherwise, why would he have the toy?
And he's scolding the puppy for doing something wrong, but you can tell he really cares about that puppy.
That's so cute.
He's got some adventuring stuff on there, but he's got a frying pan on the back. He's got his crossbow because he's an actual, an adventurer traveler. He's got some scrolls sticking out. But yeah, he's got the toy. He's got sausages. He's got cheese. It's fun.
Yeah.
It's really fun. And
yeah. He has a couple pieces that are really fun. The one that I really want to paint is called Quicksilver. It's this girl on a moped. And I think she has something on the back of the moped, like sitting on there.
It's a little robot.
I think, yeah, it's a little robot. Yeah. And I love that scene. It feels like something out of a really cool concept that, I don't know why, it just gives me a certain feeling. And I really want to paint that model at some point. I think he actually sent me the STL for that model, and I haven't printed it out yet, but that model is really cool. And I'd love to give it a shot at some point.
Okay.
This is cool. This is a wonderfully characterful model. Maybe a bit challenging to paint the face because he's holding the pug like right in front of it and stuff. But yeah, you managed to get in those eyes and get those nice specular highlights and stuff.
Yeah, I really like that because he's got, you could tell, like, even in the expression on his face, he's got a stern expression like scolding, but there's also a warmth to it and how you paint that too. But like, I liked it in the dark side to get that eye still like dark, because it'd be in dark, but then still getting all that stuff in there and the little specular highlight. I was like, I'm really proud of that, but it's also from an angle that is not an exciting angle, but like it kind of rewards you as being a three-dimensional piece of art to turn around and then see that side of it. But
what color did you use for the white of his eyes, out of curiosity?
That is the tried and true warm or red gray.
Red gray. Okay, that's a pretty mid beige brown gray thing, right?
It's a warm gray.
It's always so interesting to me how
you could find that in my signature series set by Pro Grill.
This fucking shill. it always surprises me how dark you can go with the white of the eye.
Mm-hmm. And
still have it feel like a white, you know?
Yes. So in that is not purely mixed with that color. It's actually that red gray is mixed with that warmer kind of violety purple highlight that's from the ambient light.
So it's even darker.
So it's a little darker, but it like shows that reflective nature of your eye will pick up some of the colors of the surrounding areas, especially mm-hmm. under low light situations. So yeah, then you can go real dark. I like to typically do that where I go darker than I think I should with the eye. It can always get brighter, but it's like if you go too bright, it just looks silly.
Mm. I think he nailed it. I think it looks really good.
He's a fun little guy to paint. So I had fun. And he's like, oh, it's not perfectly smooth or whatever, but it's more just focusing on trying to create the scene with the light and drawing you where you want to go. So you are traveling to Monte Sansovino as well as prior you're going to is it Germany to visit Roman Lapotte.
Yeah, and give me a second. I want to read you the message that I got from him a year ago.
Okay.
So let me find it real quick. On September 21st, 2022, he sent me this message, and I'll read just a little bit of it. Hey, Scott, hope you're doing fine. Thanks for the laughter I had yesterday with your recent video of the workspaces. Awesome. I made up my mind about things and wanted to let you know. I see you as one of the coolest miniature painting dudes on YouTube and also someone who has his heart in the right spot when it comes to passion. I'm happy that you produce so many videos and stuff and such. On the other hand, it saddens me as I see this as taking away tons of painting time when it comes to your progress and knowledge buildup. I see / feel / know that you're on the right journey and you want to learn more. The right questions arise, and I can see this in your talks and your videos about miniatures, but not in your miniatures thus far.
Woof.
I want to help you step up your game and help you sort your toolbox and knowledge. I just sent like 6 head exploding emojis to that message, because like there's a lot of emotion built up in this, and I think I've told the story before, but when I was first getting started on YouTube, I had a playlist of videos that were 10 videos about, and they were like a bunch of beginner skills, spacing, layering, shit like that. And I made a playlist of those things. And my whole strategy for YouTube was, okay, I'm going to make these technique videos, and then I'll refer to them later in my future videos. And I'll make a playlist, and it'll be a great foundation for my channel. And it turned out it was. It was a great idea. And so I took this playlist, which I had finished it all, and I sent it to like 10 different blogs. And the only person that gave me time of day was Roman in Massive Voodoo. And at that point, I love Massive Voodoo. I love reading the blog and everything. So that was so meaningful to me. And the other thing that is so meaningful to me about Roman is that he is able to paint miniatures and just not give a fuck about anyone or anything else. And I feel like I really struggle with that. Like, I really carry the weight of expectation, not only in the quality level of the paint job, but the quality level of the video and all these things. I feel like a lot of my motivation comes from, I just think people expect these things of me, or I expect it of myself. It's like, I have the capability of painting a model really well or making a really awesome video. So why wouldn't I do that all the fucking time? Which is like incredibly exhausting.
Yeah.
And I feel like for Roman, he just knows. He knows like exactly how much joy he gets out of a model, and he paints that and he doesn't do any more. And it's just like, fuck, like I just, and it still looks fucking good. And it's just like, yeah. I want to know that and harness that. I think that'd be great for me, like mentally, both in like my life and also in the hobby. That's just one small part of it. So I don't know what he wants to talk about. We talked a little bit about like topic and stuff, but it wasn't super concrete. And so about a year later, a little bit more than a year later, I am now going to this Sunday. So today is Friday. So in 2 days, I'm going to fly to Augsburg, or somewhere in Germany, East Germany, I think Berlin. And then I'm going to go to his house because he's hosting me. And I'm going to pay for it. I have to pay for the flight and do this fucking dream scenario where I get to hang out with this dude who has been such an inspiration to me, such a charitable force in the hobby, such a wealth of knowledge in the hobby. And I get to learn from him. It's just it feels like a once in a lifetime opportunity. And I'm like trying my hardest to like be in the right mental headspace to absorb it all. Cause like, I'm like stressing about filming a video and like, what's the video going to be about. And it's like, I really don't want my attention to be divided a whole lot, but I also want to capture this moment that feels like it's never going to happen again, you know?
Right. If it would, it wouldn't happen for the first time.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a certain bit of magic happening right now. And so like, I'm really conflicted right now about that. It's like, should I make a video at all? Like, I have a lot going on right now. So it's like, I could not make a video and be totally covered for like topics and shit for like the entirety of November and December.
Right.
So yeah. And then after we do a 2-day private coaching, we are going to drive through the Swiss Alps with him and one of his other painter friends to Monte San Savino, the town in Italy, which hosts the event, Monte San Savino, which is a miniature painting thing that is smaller, maybe a little bit more like painter focused than typical cons. Cons have a, like, AdeptCon has a pretty good split. I would say like maybe like half and half or like 40-60 painting gaming. This is probably more like 90-10. I mean, I don't know. I've never been, but from what I see on the outside, it seems largely painting focused, but it's smaller. It's a little bit, it's not as big and grandiose as like Nova or Adepticon.
But the sheer amount of models that are going to be there.
Yeah, the display models. No glass. They're all just sitting out on the table to look at.
Oh, baby.
A lot of heavyweights there.
Just sneeze on them.
I'm a little concerned about like feeling like a fish out of water, because like there's going to be a bunch of like really amazing, like, you know, European painters there that are just like, you know, like really, really good. And like they're probably, you know, they probably don't, they don't like hate American painters, but this is kind of like their special thing, right? And so it kind of feels like I'm invading a little bit in on their special thing. Like Eric Swinson has been adopted by them.
Yeah.
I haven't gone through that adoption phase
yet.
Well, you know?
you'll have Eric there, and he's a great guy to help kind of show you around. But in my somewhat limited experience, so like Christoph Kolchak, when he was here for Nova, and then meeting T-Bolt, who's from France, and a number of other guys, you know, and like Sergio Calvo and Angel Geraldes, these guys are huge names, right?
Yeah.
All these painters.
Yeah.
Just phenomenal award-winning painters. They're just very happy and welcoming.
Yeah.
And I think you will experience that.
I think so too.
And going in there with a bit of, you're going to go in there with a bit of like, you're going to have a humbleness to you. Just naturally, right? Because you're not going in there big dick swinging, like, I'm going to come fucking win this whole thing. Whatever. It's the sheer amount of talent that's in that room.
Yeah.
I think people will feel that energy, and that will be, you'll be, have a wonderful, welcoming experience. How cool is that fucking road trip going to be, bro?
Dude, it's going to be fucking awesome.
Oh, man.
I told my dad about it, and he was like, I don't know how he knew this, but he's like, I think the Alps has a forecast to snow during that period. And I was just like, what? Like, first
Why
of all,
would you know
how
that?
Did you know that? And second of all, that would suck if that were happening. Cause I think he said it was like to the point where like you shouldn't drive through the Alps, but we'll see what happens.
Isn't that the place where the plane crashed and the people had to eat each other? In like the,
I've heard of
like
that.
In like the 80s?
I've heard of that, but I don't know the answer.
You need to watch that movie on the plane right over there. What's a fucking movie called? Alive. Alive is the name of the movie.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, watch that in the plane ride over there. I'm sure it would be fine. Yeah, so, man, that is going to be so cool. And the thing of the food you're going
to
have.
I know, dude. I want to go out late at night in Augsburg, Germany, and just, like, film some, like, nighttime German videography and, like, maybe get, like, some fucking nighttime snacks. I don't know if they have that, but in
just sausages
and pretzels, you know, and beer.
It's a lot of sauerkraut.
Yeah. Or that too.
I don't know if I'm being racist right now, but
yeah, you are for
okay.
Sure. We were in Amsterdam, and man, the nightlife there with the food in particular, like the fucking sweets and pastries, is on point. And there's a reason why that may be the case. I'm not sure if they share that reason with Germany, but I'm curious if it's going to have like a little little nighttime snacky scene.
My thought, this is how I would approach it in terms, but you will find your own way in terms of a video for this. Go in with no expectations and no understanding what you want it to be. Have a camera accessible that it's not taking your focus and your attention, namely like stuff for like B-roll. Well, maybe there's a microphone, you know, a shotgun mic attached to the camera or something. So you have captured something, and then by the end of your trip, the story will have presented itself, and you will have enough to then pull that story together, because you'll be able to patch and fill in the holes when you're back here.
That's risky, bro.
I know it's risky, but it's the least intrusive for the being present in the experience. I think that's more important, is that you're present in the experience. But I also would hate for you to have this amazing idea or this wonderful thing that's just like, oh my gosh, it kind of writes itself. It's just kind of there, that you just kind of feel like, now I can't do it. because it can easily be a thing where the video is the inspiration for what today's video is on this story and the thing you're talking about, maybe while you're painting, while you're building, while you're doing something else, and the B-roll flipped in is from the trip. So it's kind of, you've done all that pre-work and that's the kind of inspiration what you're doing. So you don't rely 100% on all, everything you capture there to make the whole thing.
Right, yeah.
That is what I would do. We make videos differently, though. So.
Sure, yeah. And you kind of touched on, so I had this same conversation with my business coach yesterday, and he had this idea, which I really resonated with, was like, maybe the video should just be about like the degree of which I need, or like I operate with expectation in mind.
Mm.
And it's like, so you just said the phrase, going with no expectation. And I think the video could be about expectation and how it colors everything we do in life and like how I am trying to let go and seeing what happens when I let go. Mm. So that's a little bit more philosophical, a little more wishy-washy. Maybe there'll be some concrete things that come out of that experience, but that's the current idea right now.
Yeah, I like that idea a lot.
Which is, it's a little amorphous, right? So I can like shoot a bunch of shit and work it in. It doesn't need to have specific things. I'm not like getting an interview with Roman or some shit like that.
Yeah, I don't think that. I think if naturally there was like he says something profound and you had the camera rolling, like you have that.
Yeah,
and it's natural.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I mean, you always do the slow mo shot of him like rinsing out his brush or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
While you're philosophizing over the top.
There's got to be a lot of slow mo shots, brother. It's gonna be a lot of handheld, a lot of slow mo, like little motions. Yeah.
Yeah. So okay, I'm sure everyone. Speaking of sausage, everyone wants to know how the sausage is made. But I think
I'll let you know.
Yeah. You know, that is something we found ourselves in. I actively didn't even take a camera to Nova this year. I want to have an unabashed experience to really know, feel concrete in my thoughts about it as an event without being distracted of making a video. And I thought that helped me a lot. But that also is a different kind of experience than what you're doing here, where this truly is a kind of a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Even if it becomes a regular thing for you, it's kind of a catalyst moment.
Yeah.
So there, it's a thing. Like, you know, people, it's the question we get a lot. Is like, oh, while you're at something, it's like, oh, you're making a video here? Or what are you doing a video on this? Or whatever. And it's just like, kind of like, let me be a human too, please. Like, but also it's don't feel bad about asking that question because we ask ourselves that question a million times.
Everything. Yeah. So Seth Everman, a huge YouTuber, is quitting YouTube. And one of the reasons he's doing it is because he was like, when I did anything in life, when I traveled, when I experienced anything that was even slightly related to my video, the question is always, sorry, my channel, the question was always, do I make a video about this? Do I bring a camera with me? And like that, it like fucking never goes away. And it's like every idea I have for the hobby is like, oh, that should be a video idea. And it's just like it really makes you think about things in a certain way and experience things in a certain way. And yeah, having moments where you can just like chill and do the thing and experience it for yourself is important for sure.
And finding a way to, and I think you've been doing this, you've done it with like your Age of Sigmar army, you've done it with your Song of Ice and Fire stuff, is folding in the things that excite you.
Yeah, dude.
Personally into your videos is so healthy, and you feel like you've got two birds with one stone in a way.
Definitely.
And it's always the question, the only rule is like, why isn't that the obvious? That's what you always do. Well, that's not the way the YouTube algorithm works, unfortunately. And you kind of feel like you're making you're compromising in order to do that. But I think it's a healthy compromise.
It's hard though, dude. It's hard. Like when I made that Star Wars video and it did poorly, that really like kind of killed me because I was like, damn, like this feels so similar to everything that I do. Why is this sucking so much dick? And so I had kind of a come to Jesus moment, and what the result of that moment was I was like, okay, I have to think about like YouTube in a different way. Like when I first got into YouTube, I did a lot of research about what the audience wants, what mini painting on YouTube looks like, but that was fucking 8 years ago. And I haven't done any of that thinking ever. And so I'm operating with old knowledge, pieced together knowledge, which is why my videos are so hit or miss. It's like, I'll put a video out, it'll get 120K views in a month. I'll put a video out, it'll get 40K views in a month. And I'm like, and I'm sitting there like, what the fuck am I doing wrong? And so I need to figure it out. Because I feel like, and I won't talk a whole lot more about this, I feel like YouTube has this promise to creators where it's like, you can make a video about anything you want. And it will do well if you know what you're fucking doing. If you've figured out how to make amazing videos, it will work. But like, that amount of knowledge is so hard to understand and come by, and you only come to it through like years of failure and so much struggle. And it's like, if that promise didn't exist, if the CEO of YouTube came to me and he was like, Scott, we've written in the code that you will only ever get 100K views if your paintbrush touches a GW model. It's literally programmed in. It has nothing to do with people. That's just how the system works. I'd quit today. Because like, I can't, that just not, it's not the promise that I feel like YouTube is giving every creator, where it's like, do whatever you want, you'll find success if you're good at making videos. Like that's the caveat, right? And so it's a high bar. And I'm slowly trying to figure it out. And I don't know, but I want to believe that's possible. I want to believe I can paint anything and get 100K, 200K views. But I have to prove that to myself first. So we'll see.
See, the key is you don't actually have to paint a Games Workshop model. You just have to say the term Games Workshop in the title.
So I don't want to talk about this more, but I kind of want to talk about it more because I've been thinking about it a lot. But you're touching on something that's very important, and that's bridging the gap from your target audience to what your subject is. And a huge thing is like, you know, we paint models, and both of our target audiences are pretty similar. Mm-hmm. They're people who enjoy watching painting videos of GW products, like to be very specific. And so when you can kind of bridge that gap and kind of like earn that emotional investment like right away, either with title, thumbnail, first 15 seconds, then you captured that viewer, and then you're gonna get views. I think at a baseline, that's like great advice, but like how you execute on that is different every single time.
Yeah, and how you keep it fresh and different.
Yeah,
because it can quickly be a spiral of like he just keeps doing the same thing.
Yeah, dude.
With the title and thumbnail especially.
Right.
You know? And it's like, yeah, it's a whole nother can of worms to walk that line and also be true to the people that have been loyal to you and watch your videos and like you for you and like the stuff you do for the stuff you do. And those are the most important people.
Yeah.
You know, I want to stay true to them because they like the things that I do that I like to do. So I want to give them that. So,
yeah, but you nailed it. You painted a obscure 3D printed display model in a hard directional light. And it's at 120K views after 7 days, 6 days. And you did that because the title and the subject matter of the first couple minutes of the video, I did watch that part, was grabbing that audience that cares. You contextualized the subject for them, and then they were in.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows. And that, honestly, that's my guess. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's all a guess.
We don't fucking know.
Yeah.
But like, I think that's how it's supposed to work. But like this is different than YouTube. This is not YouTube anymore. This is just like I feel like a magazine editor. I feel like a fucking newspaper editor. I feel like these are just good things to do when making content for anybody is thinking about these things.
Yeah. It's like what's the front page headline, right? It's gonna be like the 1960s Superman Metropolis Daily News, right? It's the same kind of thing. It's like, what's the picture on the front page? What's the title? That's what they always talk about. And it has been since the beginning of media as we know it.
But it depends also like what city you're in. Like if you're in fucking Louisiana, they're going to care about a certain subject matter compared
hurricanes.
To New York City, right? Yeah. Or that, yeah. So yeah.
Well, that's it. They care about the hurricane news in Louisiana.
Sure.
They don't care about it in New York.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, after the hurricane came and like, you know, X number of people died in the cities in ruins or blah, 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 then they care in New York because it's...
it's
dramatic, right?
Sure. Yeah.
It's crazy and it's dramatic and people are drawn to that. This again, this all goes back, and I'm a broken record on this, but it goes back to the human psychology and how we perk up and we pay attention to things and certain things we don't.
Yeah.
Because my daily life, I go through and do all the things that I need to do the things that I want to do, the things that I have to do, the things that I don't want to do, but I know are important for me to do my daily life. Therefore, the things that I have mental space for, and this, the amount of mental space can vary person to person, but it is a universal fact that the things that I perk up to and I pay attention to are the things that jump out as dramatic and important to me, even if I didn't think they were. So that means if I'm going to catch your attention, I have to catch your attention and make it worth your time.
Yeah.
And me saying in a video title, how to layer, that's true to what the video is about. That's really important in miniature painting. I could learn a shitload in that. That does not do enough to grab somebody and say, I must watch this. This will teach me a lot. This is very important to me. That's not to say that that video will be, you know, you'll get no views. But in comparison to that same video, instead of being titled How to Layer, it's the, it could be titled the most important thing you'll ever learn about painting Warhammer. It's the same video, but I have made it unavoidable for you to feel that you need to click on that and watch that. And that is the mental process that every mini painting YouTuber that you watch or you enjoy has to go through every time they do something, because they've done the extensive amount of work to make the video, whether you watch it or not. And so it's that constant ebb and flow or pull and push on how do you stay true to what the video is about, but how do you make it scream and flashing lights that they feel like they need to click?
Yeah.
And then you have to follow through and actually have that good video. But honestly, that part is not the scary part. The actually making an awesome video, at least to me, and I think to you, your quality of your work shows it.
Thank you.
Is not, that's not the struggle. That is not the hard part. Because that's also the fun part. That's the part we're willing to sit there and rework and edit or find the correct timing. How much of this clip of the pause do I cut? Do I leave for comedic value? Yeah. Where do I? Yeah, all those little things that you
how
do.
How long is the transition? Like yes. Sound effects, all these. Yeah.
All of that is. But that's when you see it come together. It's like, oh gosh, now that scene, it works now.
Yeah.
That's. If you don't have that, you're not gonna do this long term anyway, because you got to get a certain amount of joy out of that to keep doing the work. Yeah. But it is not fun trying to come up with silly thumbnails and wackadoo titles.
Yeah,
at least not for me.
It's I think it goes more as well, like, because if you don't, obviously there's the low hanging fruit of painting a GW thing that kind of always works, and there's nothing wrong with doing that. But, like, if I were to do that Star Wars video again, it wouldn't be in the thumbnail. It wouldn't be in the title. It wouldn't be in the first 30 seconds of the video. I wouldn't talk about fucking Star Wars at all. It would just be like a... It's almost like you kind of trick people into, like, watching things, and they kind of realize, like, oh, this applies to me. Okay. And now we're painting Star Wars. It's like, okay, well, I'm already, like, invested. Then I don't really care. But it's like you just gotta frame it. You got to contextualize it in a way that earns their interest. And, like, if you immediately start with a thing where they're, like, I don't care about that thing, they're immediately tuned out before you even say anything, right? You just lost that person. And that's kind of what I was getting to with the whole newspaper. It's like if Alabama has an article called, like, titled, not to be like whatever, but like, you know, like some kind of like liberal thing, like a liberal meetup as a newspaper article, like how many views and clicks and impressions in a newspaper sense is that going to get? It's not going to get a lot, because you're not thinking about the people and what they care about in your area, in our case, in our subscription base. So it's important to think about that in a huge way. But I mean, you're right. But also the other thing is that the structure of the video also needs to support the title and the thumbnail as well. So that's not like that isn't like technique, editing and transitions and shit like that, and like audio levels and stuff. But that does change how you format the video and what order you present information and all this shit. Anyways,
I think so. It's so important to just make the video you want to make first, and then you know what it is, and so then you can feel more confident in the way that you want to present it.
Yeah, but
you know what the thing is.
I've done that and it's failed so many times. So I feel like I gotta I need to think about it before I really start to establish what the order of events is in the video.
Mm.
Really? I had that April, man, where I painted four display models in a row. Three, and then that sci-fi, that small sci-fi diorama. And every single one of those videos sucked ass for performance. And I've painted display models before, and it's gotten a lot of views. So I had other things that didn't do super well. So there's something I'm not understanding, and I'm trying to figure it out. But I'm encouraged at the moment to really try to think about it and figure it out and see if anything happens. Maybe nothing will come of it. But at the very least, the hamster in the wheel is running at max rip right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's all American Ninja Warrior. What it is it's all American Ninja Warrior course. But if you decide to do a video on painting a display model, the American Ninja Warrior course is not the same course as you're going to have to run if you are painting a Space Marine.
Yeah.
They're both an American Ninja Warrior course, and you still got to go through the right sessions or the right parts of the course correctly. But it's totally achievable to still be successful on that harder course, but you just have to understand going into it that you really got to nail some part of it really well in order to get them in.
Yeah.
It is the whole thing. And this episode has just turned into the kind of conversation Scott and I usually have over eating chicken tendies over lunch.
This is the main topic.
Yeah, this is just us talking about, like, the interesting, well, it's interesting to us. I don't know about you guys, but like this is the part of the going from visiting Rome in the Pot in Monte Sansovino to what video you're going to make there.
Right. It's so like, what's that going to be called? Like, what's that video going to be called? You know, how do I make that experience interesting to someone who doesn't give a shit, who doesn't know who Rome in the Pot is, doesn't give a shit about display painting, doesn't give a, you know, whatever, any of that stuff. You know, it's like, that's a thing I have to think about. The last time I made a video about Rome of the Pot, I called it the YouTube bubble, and I like have a very artsy name and a very artsy thumbnail, and that video also did terribly. Yeah. So I got to think about that. You know, it's an important thing to do.
Yeah, it is. Okay, we are going to actually have a real topic today, but it's probably not going to be a real long one, but we think it's a fun one,
an interesting one,
because we've already talked so long.
Hour 18.
Dude, we're getting good at this talking a long time thing.
Okay. A little too good, actually.
So, yeah, for our own good. Interesting thing about this. So I listened to a video games podcast. It's a kind of like a general video games podcast called Grinding Gear, the Grinding Gear podcast. And these two guys, they've been playing Blizzard games together for years. They're big Heroes of the Storm players. They're Hearthstone players. They were, what's the other one? Overwatch,
yeah.
They both played WoW way back when people played WoW, and now they're into Final Fantasy 14. But anyway, neither here nor there. So one lived in Florida, one lived in Washington State, literal opposite parts of the country. Their YouTube channel, their streaming, and their podcast are now doing well enough to where their Garrett and Kyle are now moving to the same state. And they both have spouses. Garrett has a child, and his wife's pregnant with the second child. No, Kyle. Anyway, either way. So the guy from Washington's moving to Florida. And they just recorded their first podcast in person. Typically, their podcasts are right about an hour each episode. It's one podcast a week. Their very first one was almost 2.5 hours because they were in person. And that, I don't think they even mention it in the episode, that it's not a topic of discussion at all. I noticed it immediately because I'm like, you motherfuckers see what it's like when you're in person. It just goes so much more like off the rails or tangents, or you just talk because you're just talking instead of this virtual kind of barrier that keeps things closer.
I think if it's easier to like interrupt someone while they're speaking or find that moment where like they've completed a thought and now you can go before they start their next one, that's when you get the tangents, right?
Yes.
It's like you said something that sparked a memory. Let me jump in here. And that's a lot harder to do when you're like in Discord, you know?
Yeah, because that gap in time, because of the slight delay, that gap in time, half the time at least, they are starting talking again when you do that jump in.
Exactly, yeah.
You don't have the physical cues. You don't have the immediate audio feedback. Mm-hmm. And it's just the talk over. You do the talk over a couple of times, and then you're gun shy, and then you don't want to talk over, you never interject. And it's just a...
There's probably a skill to it. Like, it's probably, if you did it a lot, you'd probably get, like, better at it. But I feel like there'd always be some amount of, like, latency and, like, the, can I go? I don't know.
It certainly is a skill. And I've seen people that podcasts that really do it well. But it's, like, it's evolved over doing it a lot of times and kind of understanding the ebbs and flows.
Can our podcast pop off so, like, I can just, like, fuck around with my YouTube channel and not care about performance?
Yeah.
We need a content strategist for our podcast. Like, we need someone who's, like... who's amazing at social media and also tapped into the hobby, and they'll be like, this is what you got to do to make amazing podcasts. And I'd be like, okay, fuck yeah. I just want someone whose job it is to tell me that, please.
And we need G Fuel to sponsor us.
Yes, please.
Dude, because G Fuel sponsors all sorts of streamers and shit. I'm drinking G Fuel today, so they get in on their radar. So you just need a bunch of sponsors, and then we can do that. Okay, all right, problem solved.
Easy.
Today's topic is brought to us by Scuba Steve.
Scuba Steve, what is that topic?
Okay, he wants us to rehash the topic of professional miniature painters.
So we must have talked about this before, but I don't remember.
Yeah, it might be, we may have done it in passing or as part of another topic. That's where my spiderweb-filled brain is going with this.
I'm mostly blackout whenever we record that.
Yes, it's gone from my brain until I listen to it later. Okay, so I'm gonna read his entire question. We'll just kind of go with it because it's a bit of a long one. Rehash on the topic of professional miniature painters. At what point would you guys consider someone a professional painter? What criteria would someone have to meet to slap on the title to do that? For some context, having a profession in something requires prolonged training and formal qualifications. What, if any, of those things would get you that title? Could it be based on placing in formal competitions, or maybe it's just being paid to paint miniatures? We'd love to hear you guys ramble on this topic. So, professional miniature painters. So I did a little what you call a Webster's Dictionary definition research.
Okay.
And
let's start.
Professional, there's adjectives and there's noun versions. So there's the two main noun definitions, and they're separate. The first one being, and I don't think they're in any particular order, but there are two. The first one is having a certification or professional training, such as a lawyer or a doctor. That's like the end of the definition.
Having professional training.
Yeah.
So in this case, like going to law school or...
Yeah, and maybe it's better that I actually look this up and read it, but I'm not going to do that.
Okay.
And the second one was... doing a task is your main form of income as opposed to as a hobby. They didn't use the word hobby, but it was kind of synonym for hobby. As pastime. I think they used pastime.
Okay.
And that was it. Also, one sentence definition.
That has been my classical understanding of whatever profession is, whether you're a professional video game player or a professional hobbyist, is that you do it for a living.
Yeah. And so I think that's the low-hanging fruit, and we can discuss that in more in depth because I think that there is some depth there. But we can go back to the first one because there is no certification, professional certification for being a professional miniature painter. But there are kind of things. They're almost like a checkbox of things that they're not explicitly you do them and then it makes you that, and then you can put it on a business card, but they imply that. Okay,
you're saying like the ability to accomplish certain techniques, is that what you're saying?
No, it's not even techniques.
Okay,
it's by checking the box that you do these things. Let me give you an example.
All right,
do you teach miniature painting at a convention?
Sometimes.
Okay, if you teach miniature painting at a convention, we assume that makes you a professional because you are teaching someone, you are charging money. We're getting the money thing in here, but it's different than the second form of the definition. That you have a level of expertise worthy of some group of people paying for you to teach them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's one.
Okay.
Number two, you do box arts.
Mm.
You paint box arts for the official paint job of a miniature. Okay.
Okay. How many of these items are there?
I don't know. This is all off the top of my head.
Oh, okay.
I don't know how many. But that's another one.
Okay. That one to me, I think we're gonna answer this question colored by our own opinions. Because like there are certain things that you're probably gonna value in a painter like more or differently from me. And for some reason that last one is like the not most important, but that's the one that like would be the best signal to me that someone is a pro. If like a display model company that I recognize and know has hired someone to paint one of their newest figures for box art. Like that's like, okay, you've kind of made it in the pro mini painting scene because you are being paid to paint and you're being paid by one of these niche brands that don't have a lot of options. And they picked you. They don't make a lot of models. That feels like a pretty good indicator to me.
Or maybe you came in at the right price point too.
Yeah.
You know, you're cheaper.
There's a lot of caveats to all of these, you know, just because you run a class at a convention does not mean that you know what you're fucking talking about or that you know how to teach people in general, you know, like there's a lot of what ifs.
Yeah, we do have a caveat here. We were talking about caveats and not putting caveats in your YouTube videos, but we're going to put a caveat.
A podcaster, okay, for podcast, like extended, you know, yes. Discussion.
Great caveat that this is our opinion, and there may be a little bit of spiciness in our opinions on this. At least I feel like I feel it bubbling in mine right now.
You're bubbling, bro.
I'm bubbling. And teaching painting at a convention or an event or whatever is one of them for me.
Yeah. Like maybe he's got a hookup with the convention coordinator, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's that. There are people that go out of their way to consistently ask, they determine who is the person that schedules those things, and they bug them and bug them and bug them.
Yeah, yeah.
And to get themselves in there. Before I forget it, though, there's another one I just thought of.
Okay.
You've placed at a reputable painting competition, or maybe any painting competition, or maybe there's just a elitist tier of painting competitions that you've placed at, or you've placed consistently at. I don't know, again, ethereal about what that means, but that if you've done so well, if you've performed so well, that means you're a professional. And it oftentimes it felt like it, like when I was new to the hobby and we'd go to Adepticon and see who the teachers were and looking at which classes we were going to take and stuff, those kind of went hand in hand. It felt like the people that, maybe it was just because I was less knowledgeable back then, but it felt like the people that were teaching were all people I could link to their successes in competitions with previous pieces.
Especially early on at Adepticon, a lot of the painter display people are all people that just competed in Crystal Brush. That's really what it was entirely.
Yeah. And now, like Adepticon, Nova, Gen Con, Reaper Con, I'm just talking about American ones because I know them more. It feels like that contingent of people that are teaching there don't necessarily have those boxes checked.
Yeah,
and
it's still some of them, but it's definitely less, though.
It's not as much. Maybe it's because there's more classes offered now. Maybe because the hobby is bigger. And maybe this person that's teaching here is, maybe they haven't won a Crystal Brush or a Golden Demon or whatever, but they have a sound understanding and a way of teaching for new painters. So their skill level doesn't need to be super high.
There's also more info available now for people to learn and then become capable of teaching without competing and going through that process, you know?
Yeah. So all of that to say, and this is not throwing shade on any particular person. And if you teach at a miniature painting competition, whether it's local or it's a big one, and you don't have that, I have not been paid to do box arts. I haven't won anything. This is not me saying you shouldn't teach. Don't misunderstand that. What I'm trying to get at, though, is chart tie to determine if that factor should come into play in the determination is if someone is a professional. And I say no. if you teach miniature painting, that does not make you a professional miniature painter, because there is a strong list of people that do that that I would not categorize as professional miniature painter.
Okay. I have a question for you. If you could go to the University of Miniature Painting, it's probably pretty easy to think about what classes you could take.
Yeah.
But what would the available majors be at the University of Mini Painting?
I think if you'd look at like art colleges, and to look at what can you get a degree in an art college, is probably a good comparison there.
Sure.
And oftentimes those are, and correct me if I'm wrong for people in the comments that understand this better, but you have an art degree with a specialty in X. So it's considered a well-rounded degree, but this is your area of focus. And it could be sculpting. It could be painting. It could be illustration.
Okay.
It could be graphic design.
Well, how about the hobby world? What would it be?
It would. I think there's just the one.
What's the one?
Miniature painting.
Oh, really? Okay, that's it. I think that is a little bit different. I think that you can have a focus in army painting. I think you can have a focus in speed painting individual figs. I think you can have a focus in display painting. I think you can have a focus in sculpting models.
Yeah, I guess like sculpting is
very different. But yeah. I truly think that at the very least, the skills required to paint an army are vastly different than the skills required to paint a display model.
Okay, riddle me this then. If I am an amazing army painter, I could teach, write the rule book, teach the classes as an amazing army painter. Does that mean I can find success as the highest level display painter that competes? And the opposite. If I am Michael Pisarski, can I then also make army paint an army as good in the same amount of time as somebody else?
Oh, no, absolutely not. No way.
I'm not saying the same day. I'm saying given enough time to learn that. One of those things is absolutely true. Michael Pisarski, Ben Komets, they're so good at a thing that is so very difficult.
Yes.
That if they put their attention in that, I have no doubt. They, with their understanding of art and what makes it work, what's important, what to paint, what to emphasize, what not to emphasize, their use of color, their use of light. But to do that at a speed level, this is a broad generalization. But I think that they absolutely could be a master of army painting. I do not believe that everyone that's really good at army painting can do what they can do at a display level.
Given enough time.
Given a reasonable amount of time. Let's say 1 year.
Okay. Maybe. So the reason why I asked that question, because what I wanted to ask you, which we can get into this later or not at all, was just like how many proficiencies
sure
must a person have to be professional, you know? But to answer the question that you just posed, you posed another interesting question, which is like at the highest level, who makes more money? Someone who's really good at army painting? Someone who's really good at display painting? And I don't know. There are people who paint whole armies and probably make a fuckload of money doing that. Like, there's one person that I'm thinking of right now who makes these amazing display model boards. He used to have a booth at Adepticon. Mm. I've heard him finger painting models, but like they look so good, I don't understand that. It's like that guy probably has a very specific clientele list who is willing to pay maybe five figures, clearly five figures for that kind of job. And if he can pump that out once every 2 months, like, he's making three figures a year, you know? And it's like, is this a display model painter making that much? Like, I don't know. But this is all napkin math right now. But, yeah. Like, so I don't know if it's a super easy comparison for the money earned. But to answer your second question, which was given a year, I think it depends on the person.
Yes.
For me specifically, like, when I started to really get into army painting, I started to realize all these deficiencies that I had. And maybe it's because I'm just in my head so much and like thinking about like, oh, what am I doing wrong? Like all the time. But it feels like it's a huge skill. And I feel it feels like I'm kind of bad at it. And I'm like still learning or relearning really how to paint an army. Cause that's where I started in the hobby, was painting armies. And then I kind of went away from it. And now I'm kind of coming back to it.
Yeah.
And I feel like I suck at it. So,
it's a different, you're utilizing different techniques and in different ways.
So I don't know. I don't know to answer your question, but you think that Michael Pisarsky could figure out how to paint an army in a year as well as that person, but the person who can't paint the army that well couldn't figure out how to do what Michael Pisarsky does in a year.
To make it a little bit probably more palatable, if you had the 100 best display painters in the world and the 100 best army painters in the world, and you all gave them the task of 1 year to be as best as you possibly can as the other group.
Yeah.
I would bet a lot of money on the fact that the people that are the display painters, more of them would check whatever your box of proficiency level would be of that 100, would check the box from the army painter group than the other way around.
Okay.
I think that the high level of understanding that's needed for the display translates so much better than the other way around. I think there's so much level of learning that you can be an awesome army painter that, like, you still have so many things to get to that. Not even like as good as Lan, but like
to get to how good Lan was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, which was still like crazy.
It's
still mind blowing. Yeah. It's like, I remember the first time he put out that Barbarian NMM and I saw that paint job and I was just like, is that NMM? I actually don't know. And it was mind blowing like that many years ago. And then you got fucking big Russian bear coming out with this like hyper realistic photorealistic NMM, and now it's just like insane. Yeah. You might be right. I don't know the answer to the question, but you could be right. Maybe display painting is a better foundation of skills for that future to come.
Yeah, and I also think of most of us, those listening and us as well here, we do a bit of both.
Yeah, I think for sure. Yeah,
I mean there are some people that just do one. You see that most specifically in like these display painters, like.
Well, that's a question. I think there are definitely more army painters than there are display painters.
Yeah. That typically, if people are really committed to doing display painting, I don't see Instagram posts about their new new army 40K or whatever.
Every once in a while, they're painting like one model at a time, hey, you know, that doesn't work. That doesn't cut it.
I see Sergio Calvo post pictures of all these boxes of shit for his next army, but I ain't never seen any of that shit painted.
Brother painted. He bought so many Necrons, dude. Yeah. He had like 20 boxes.
That's not the first time he's done that either.
No, it isn't.
And I've never seen the final army on the last
Sergio,
one either from 2 years ago.
What does your backlog look like?
Yeah, dude.
That's one purchase.
Throw down the gauntlet, bud. Let's see them Necrons painted.
Let's see that army, brother.
It's going to take you 3 months just to build that shit.
Yeah, no fucking shit. Way longer than to paint Necrons.
Okay, so we can come to the conclusion that because there is no official certification or title, you know, it's not like you're, it'd be sweet if like you could get Esquire. Like if you were like Scott Walter Esquire.
What is an Esquire?
Esquire is a lawyer term. It means it's a certain certification as a lawyer, and then you have that like title.
Okay.
So how fucking sweet with that?
Okay. The only time I've ever heard the word Esquire used, and I'm sure you know, is from
magazine.
Oh no, fucking Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Oh no, I wasn't thinking of it from the. I've spent so long since I've seen that movie. That recent, somewhat recent now, Denzel Washington movie, where he plays a lawyer. And he's Esquire.
Okay.
Yeah. So the abbreviation is ESQ. Period.
Yes.
So that's what we need to do. We need to start like the shoddy for-profit online college, where you end with a certification in miniature painting, and then we just make up a random title, and then you can put that. It's an official title you can put on shit.
No, we don't need to do anything more.
Okay, because there's other people that do a painting academy. Is that I forgot that that's an actual thing you can do.
But also, we still got to do our magazine. We got all these other things.
TV
show.
We got
to run a con, a TV show. Yeah.
So many things we need to do.
So many things.
Okay, so there's that. So there is no official certification. So, but that doesn't, due to the other definition of being a professional, that doesn't exclude anyone miniature painting from being able to call themselves a professional, just because there's no official certification. Now there is a school of hard knocks, which pretty much that's what all of us have to go through in miniature painting, because there is no official education like staircase that you've got to go up. It is all figuring it out, absorbing, committing time, prioritizing, learning from a variety of people, and execution and repetition, and in order to get there. So we all have the ability to do that education. That's why we're making YouTube videos. That's why that you can join people's Patreons to get feedback. There's all these things. They're kind of your way of progressing. Not that everyone wants to be a professional, but like you're progressing that same line that someone that did want to be a professional, you're working your way up the same ladder at your own pace.
All right, I got a question for you. Yeah. So obviously the definition of you need to make a living off of this to be a professional is one. But let's get more quantitative. How much money annually after taxes do you need to make to be a professional? Because that there are some people that can live on ramen in a duplex. Does that make you a professional? If like with my career, not mine specifically, but someone else's career, they can pay for a mortgage and support a family. Is that the same level of professional? So how much cash
okay.
in USD?
USD.
Annually post-tax.
So to me, the big thing is where there's the biggest word that needs to be highlighted, underlined, and in all caps in this sentence is your primary source of income. Right. So that means this isn't like, oh, I'm a professional miniature painter and I also work at Target 4 days.
Oh, no. Yeah. No, none of that shit. None of that shit.
This is what you do to pay all your bills.
Would you count like T-shirts? If you had like a sick logo and you're selling T-shirts and you made like
100%.
OK,
because that is your brand. That is your brand. And that goes into it. Yes.
OK.
That all everything that falls under that umbrella, that all counts.
OK.
Well, the big, to me, yes, you touched on one thing is your life. What are the expenses in your life?
Yes, I wanted to say equal the playing field, you know?
Well, there's a bigger factor in this that we probably need to discuss, and that is geographic location.
Right, and that's another thing. It's cheaper to live maybe in Poland than it is like maybe in Spain or like whatever it is. But if we just equal the playing field to a dollar amount, then everyone has to play at the same level, right?
And I think that number should be something that if you worked at McDonald's, it would be like the same amount of money.
You think so?
Yes. I think it should be that if you can live without government assistance at that job, working a full-time job.
Okay. So that's your level. Okay.
That's my level.
Okay. So the thing is that
minimum wage then, right?
Yeah, but that's different for everywhere. I guess so, but you're saying is the amount of money you need to live where you are at. That's different everywhere, right?
Yeah, that's different. So we're just trying to, we could say here's a dollar amount, and then that could change to their currency, but in their country, it maybe could be a lot more. I mean,
it could be, yeah. So like if I say like 50 grand, for instance, maybe that's like way more money than you need to live somewhere else.
I think there are existing professional miniature painters, if we want to put people in that category, that make less than that and that are professional.
Oh, absolutely. And they probably, yeah, make enough to live. But yeah, I'm going to say 50 grand post taxes. That makes you professional for the paid for metric of the term.
Let me see, because I know this is my first, my first job out of college.
Just throwing shit across the bow here. At Goody PPs. Don't read too much into this.
My first job out of college, granted, this was a good number of years ago, only 20 years ago. But I think
only 20 years ago,
$31,200. That's how much I made right out of college as a 4-year degree. $31,200. That is $15 an hour.
How did you pull that up so fast?
You just take the hourly rate times 2080. That's how many hours. If you work 40 hours a week, that's gotcha. How many hours you work in a year.
Yep.
So that amount.
That's pre-tax.
That's pre-tax.
Yeah. So it's like 20% lower than that.
With that amount, you're not buying a house.
No.
You're not. You can't afford kids. Probably.
Probably not.
I mean, unless you have your spouse also has a job and
whatever. Yeah.
Like we're getting into the economics here. That's probably not necessarily. But yeah, I mean, the issue is like you can do that and be a professional. But if circumstances changes in your life where you're not living in an apartment with a roommate anymore and you have a significant other and you want to,
or you have health problems,
you need health insurance, yeah, in America,
brother.
Good fucking luck,
dude. I pay monthly for health insurance and it just went up $490 a month, and that gives me a deductible of $7,000.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means for people out there that are not blessed by American healthcare is that I need to pay out of pocket for medical procedures that aren't just checkups, annual checkups, $7,000 in procedures before my insurance will start covering anything. That's what you're, that's a premium, right?
Yeah. Yes. And you get the lovely benefit of also paying almost $500 a month on top of that.
Yep.
That doesn't count towards the $7,000.
Nope. It's highway fucking robbery.
Yes. If I had the option to get that rate that you have there, I'd take it in a heartbeat because they'd laugh at me if I asked for that because
he had to pay for insurance.
Pre-existing condition, baby.
Yeah, it would be way more.
Yeah, they can look at everything that you have afflicted with you and the price keeps going up.
Right.
And up. And up. But anyway, that is a very good point. If you need health insurance, if you have a kid, if you want to buy a house, if you want to get married, if you want to have pets, if you want to move out of a sketchy neighborhood, blah, 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 blah. Now that $15 an hour that would categorize you as professional probably caused you to quit that job and get a job that pays more and you're no longer a professional miniature painter because you can't afford it anymore.
Yeah. And we're starting to touch into this world of why are there more display painters in other parts of the world other than America? And that's because they are able to do that kind of career in art and be able to afford things like health insurance and stuff like that and not have that issue.
Because it's included in most European countries.
Right. Yeah. And so that makes sense. They can do that career and they can support that lifestyle in that particular area.
Cost of living.
We're not so fortunate, unfortunately.
And we're also kind of we're also kind of dealing with the pay structure, the payout, the income possibility is kind of based on the U.S. dollar, too.
Yeah, yeah.
So $300 to do a box art for a company.
$300?
Listen, there was a miniature.
$300.
There was a miniature painter that we know that maybe a year ago now, kind of went off on social media telling people to quit taking $300 for box arts, that's not good for the environment of our hobby. It's not good for people trying to do this as a profession. People are lowballing people to take less money because the companies are, well, they'll just kind of pay the lowest hanging fruit of a certain quality level. And that dollar amount was stated. That's why I said that.
Okay. So I'm just curious. Do you think that's enough for the box art job? I don't know.
I don't think so at all.
Anywhere fucking near enough.
No.
Well, it depends on the model, of course, right?
Yeah. It's probably add another zero on that and we should start talking.
Yeah. Like, okay. Okay. Whew! I thought we were in a totally different train of thought here. But yeah, like that needs to be way higher. It should be way higher.
But the market dictates what it costs.
Yes, yes.
And if people are doing that, and I agree with this artist that said that you're chopping each other off at the ankles.
Yep.
In order if that's what we're doing, but that's just it. The more people that are of a certain level are entering the field, then there's more kind of competition and what's a company willing to pay. Also, these companies, if they're saying they can't pay more than that, then maybe you need a different business model.
Yeah. Maybe, yeah. So, okay, I figured it out. Here's how you determine if you're a professional miniature painter.
Okay, we got it. We got there.
When your value offering is unique enough to the point where people care to invest in it, and that can be either you have a low price and that's valuable, you paint in a style that is unique to you and is not replicatable and that's value. So you have a value offering that is unique and compelling and people are willing to invest in it, whatever it is, whether it's monetary or skill driven.
Yeah. It's investing. I mean, investing could be wanting to do the box art. Investing could be they want you to, teach at a convention and you can charge a good amount and students will pay it.
Yeah.
That's a big part. It can mean you have a Patreon and people are willing to pay for it, direct to consumer thing.
Yeah, or is there a career in the world of advising on the sculpts for 32 millimeter models or any kind of model? Like, like maybe you don't have the sculpting skills, but you can consult and be like, these certain details need to be in this certain way, like consulting for a company. I think Alfonso Heraldes does that a lot. He's also a sculptor in a huge way, but I know he also advises and scales 75 sculpts like to make them more
paintable. He's employed by them.
Yeah, but he has like the weirdest career with him. I don't really even know what it is.
I don't think they know what it is.
I mean, yeah, maybe it's redefining itself often.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
It's a very artsy approach to business.
Yeah.
No, we don't know.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, my thought about this is like, this is more important to this pointless discussion than it is in reality, right? Let me give you a great example.
Okay.
I'll give you two examples. One, the great Willie Hanna, and two, one Vince Venturella. Neither of those, by definition, are professional miniature painters. Neither of those use it as their main source of income. And neither of them have had a certification in miniature painting. And yet, Will Hahn is in very recent memory, as recent as this same year, has won the greatest like awards you can win in miniature painting. Vince Venturella has a backlog and a list of his accomplishments of consistent high-level work for years. And it's insane how much he pumps out at a high level. And neither of those guys are professional. If I were to ask either of them, does it matter to you that you're not a professional, or do you consider yourself a professional? Whatever they decide or whatever they respond with that, I'd say great, because that does not take away from their catalog of work, from their skill set, from how the public views them. So what's the point of the word? What's the point? It's just to, is it a level of your own like just worry about yourself to feel like I feel like I should have to say this, or is it a way to try to put people in boxes to say he is a professional and he isn't, or she's a professional and he isn't?
I think that's a huge thing. I think humanity in general loves to categorize and put things in boxes, right?
And that's how you say who's good and who's not, right?
It also gives you a goal, like on a more positive note, it gives you a goal for like what to strive toward if you want to be that kind of thing. Like what are the qualifications for it? But also, yeah, it's another way to label people and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I got a question for you that might be maybe a little depressing. That's the wrong word. If you had never started YouTube, do you think you could cut it as a professional miniature painter in the most basic definition? So making a living just doing it. No YouTube allowed. No podcast before YouTube. None of it. No social outreach. Just your painting ability and how far that carries you on Instagram and Patreon and whatever. Do you think you could cut it in a year? I don't think I could.
No, I don't think I could either.
Maybe not. 4-3 years, right, like of really fucking working at it, but like, because I would paint display models, and no one would give a shit about that. You know,
I think you could be very good at that.
Sure, yeah. I don't think it would sustain like my lifestyle though.
Here's my thought on that. Well, one, if I needed to pay for health insurance, no, I wouldn't even. I wouldn't even start. Here's the thing, and I think this is true of both of us. If we started out with that being our goal, and that's what we're trying to do, somewhere along the line, fairly early on, we would integrate into it, whether it would be Twitch streaming more directly. You'd integrate Patreon, because that's a really big part of this.
Yeah, a lot of people do that.
Most creators.
Yeah.
I think of even people like Richard Gray is such a prime example. Richard Gray doesn't have all this stuff out there everywhere that is promoting himself, you know. But he's got a very successful Patreon. His whip pictures, good old Richard Gray whip, never a completed model, on Instagram are phenomenal.
Yeah.
And he, having met him a couple of times, He's just a shy, soft-spoken guy.
Yeah, yeah.
You and I would get into this, and then after about a week of, like, posting Patreon, like, videos of us painting, we would quickly inject more of our dumbass personality into that, and that would then set us on a different trajectory entirely. Because yeah. there's a level of the things that we get enjoyment out, bring satisfaction to, that are not just the tangible picture and video and execution.
Yeah.
I think it would, the path that you're on for each of us in this journey, whether it's for miniature painting or some other part of your life, is do not fight the current.
Yeah.
And we would end up, like, we'd be like, I'm gonna fucking beat Kirill Kana of MSS next year. You know, that's what I'd start with. And then within 6 months, I'd be like, boo, I'd be way over here. And I'd be making stupid fart noises in my videos and shit like that. So, you know, it's like, we're all on our own trajectories. And just, you know, be you and what really drives you and excites you.
I have a fun Richard Gray story. A long time ago, I remember when I first discovered Richard Gray's Instagram, and he had maybe 5-6 years ago, he had like five-figure followers on his Instagram. He had like 50K, 60K, 70K followers, and I was like, holy shit, I have never found a miniature painter that has this kind of pull. What is going on? And I looked at his posts, and he has tons of likes, and he had a lot of tags. And I didn't use tags in my posts back then. And so what I did was I literally copied and pasted the tags he used. yeah, because he used the same ones every single post. I copied and pasted them and used them on all of my posts at that time. So if you, like, go back, no one's going to do this. But if you compare the posts at a similar time frame, they're the exact same tags. I just totally stole it right from him.
Yeah. Just, like, rubbing your evil hands together.
You know, if people are going to do the work to figure out what works, you know, if Mr. Beast is going to show me how to make a good YouTube video and shit, or if Linus Tech Tips is going to show me, like, what's a good thumbnail, and then they've done the market research and they got the team to do it, I'm going to fucking steal that work, you know? That's the whole thing, right? They're the first one to get to that point of view, but, you know, I'm going to take that knowledge they've accrued and use it for myself. So same for Richard Gray. He probably figured out a good combination of keywords, and I just fucking stole them all.
Yeah, I don't think that's stealing at all. That is the history of humanity, is learning from those that have had success before you.
Yep.
Instead of, like, you know, when a new car company comes out, when Tesla first launched, they didn't have to rediscover how wheels work.
Right.
That's not stealing.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is just learning from and adapting and improving on, if maybe over time. So yeah. It's like,
yeah, yeah. And you have, there is a, it's super value to being the first one to finding something. So
yeah.
They're still on top. Don't worry.
I thought the story was going to go a dark place.
A dark place.
I was like, oh yeah. And I messaged him, and Richard Gray told me, all you got to do is go to this, you know, Chinese website, and you can buy followers.
No, you can buy
likes, and it's really freaking easy. It's like $12 a month and whatever. I thought that's where it was gonna go with things. Scott tells the whole world that it's like, all my Instagram followers are fake.
No, luckily not that.
Oh, okay. Well, that's fine. You could also do that.
Is that about it for this topic?
Yeah, I think we came to the conclusion that it doesn't matter.
It's a waste of time.
It's a waste of time. Appreciate people that you appreciate in the hobby. Take classes from people that you appreciate their work or how they teach, or you've heard great things about them. Follow people that inspire you. The title is irrelevant.
Yeah.
You know.
It is. Yeah. You'll make it if you can make it. If not, it's not a measure of whether or not you're a pro.
All right, we are here with the late breaking news, which is neither late nor breaking. Actually, it's probably late.
Yeah, it's probably late.
First one is the World Championships of Warhammer are coming up November 16th through 19th, with 340 players from over 40 countries coming to compete in 40K, Age of Sigmar, Kill Team, and Underworlds. It'll be live streamed on the Warhammer Twitch channel. Okay, so I went through and I read this article. I mean, skim/read, a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B there. And I kept looking for that thing. I kept looking for it, kept reading. Nope. There's no prizes.
None?
None. They don't mention prizes literally anywhere.
There's got to be a trophy.
The fuck is the point?
There's got to be a trophy, bro.
You cannot tell me it's a world championship shit, and you're bringing people from 40 countries over to compete, and they have this whole point system and how all these things work, and you get zero fucking dollars.
Oh, you want dollars.
I want something. I want something.
Here's why you're wrong.
That's what Vince would say if you wanted to do a cash tournament gaming.
Wait, you want to have actual champions. You want people actually playing the heart at the highest possible level. You put a fucking carrot there, bud.
Yeah, dude. Well, I mean, is bragging rights enough of a carrot?
Made me think about the Olympics, right?
Yeah, no cash.
I mean, they get athletes get sponsored to train and whatever, and then they get paid to train and get ready.
Yes, that is true.
It's different in different countries, too. Like, you're in fucking Russia, dude. You're living like a fucking czar as you're a Olympic athlete.
Yeah, that's true. You get paid by an organization to compete.
And then you get that fucking Wheaties money afterwards, bud.
Wheaties.
Yeah, so, you know, if GW says, like, okay, for the champion in each of these four things, we're going to then have you, we're going to sponsor you for a calendar year or whatever in perpetuity to be the face of this, and you'll get paid to be on advertisements, or we'll have you on to do a special strategy articles, and you get paid for that, or you get an actual fucking gold medal that, worst case scenario, you can fucking sell that thing for scrap for like $8,000. I don't know, something. I know this isn't the Olympics, but this goes back to my thought that this is not an actual competitive game. It's not. It's just not, because they cannot give money because it's a fucking crap shoot.
John is fired up.
I fucking hate this. I hate this. This is so ridiculous. It does not have to be directly cash, but you have to commit something.
They got
to
have a trophy.
They got to have the fucking coolest shit ever. That's worth, it's got to be worth something. Like, it's got to be worth something.
Like the golden demon. Would the Slayer sword be worth something to you? An equivalent thing to that?
It doesn't have the history of this, of the competition, the gumption, because I feel like Golden Demon's closer to the Olympics than this trying to make a tournament thing work.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when you're going, when you don't have the history, you have to rev up that fucking engine hard from the start to show our commitment. And the company makes so much fucking money, and they ain't paying their employees with the money. So where's the money going?
Andy Smiley, he gets it all.
It's just like six old white dudes. They get all the money. Yeah. It's us shareholders. I get it. But no, it's like, if you're really committed and you really can stand behind your game and you think this is an actual competitive game that you want to that the best of the best will continually rise to the top, because the game is not who got the most double turns and who rolled the most sixes over the course of 1,000 dice rolls, then put your money where your mouth is, motherfuckers.
Yeah, I think what Vince would say to this, because I kind of agree to you. I want to live in a world where we can have cash prizes for gaming tournaments. But I think the problem is that because these games aren't like omega balanced, a cash prize brings out the worst in a game system. It brings out the win-at-all-cost players, because of course you're going to play like that. And for a game like Warhammer, Age of Sigmar, where there's 28, 26 factions, like, there's no chance you've, like, figured out all the angles and fixed all the problems, and there are no busted lists, right? And they're going to come out. They're going to come out. And that isn't fun. And that's not what Warhammer and playing war games is about. So I feel like that's, like, the devil's argument for why cash prices aren't going to work in a system like...
I 100% agree.
And so, maybe the question is, are there any war games that would work for? You know, are they all in a similar boat? Like, obviously, GW is one to pick on because they have such a huge fucking game. But are any games, you know, good for cash prizes? I don't know.
My rebuttal to that remark is,
yeah,
then you do not market or create an event and advertise it as the World Championships of Warhammer.
Okay, so this is the expectation.
Yes. No one set the expectations but themselves.
Okay, what would it be called then? What should you call it?
It would just be call it like the grand get together.
Okay, the big like, BBQ?
Yeah, it's just like whatever is the theme of the state of Minnesota, the great Minnesota get together. The great Warhammer get together. I don't know. But see, the thing is they are selling you a bill of goods that they have no intention on cashing.
Okay.
They are selling you something that does not exist.
I can get behind what you're saying right now, because this also pisses me off when, like, expectations are set and they're just like not met. Like you're on a different page than the creator or the organizer. So I get that.
I love when we went to Nova and we go to Adepticon and you go around the tournament halls and people are playing in the big ones, even at fucking LVO in this world's most massive 40K tournament. People are there laughing, they're rolling dice, they're playing sketchy lists, they're whatever. And they flew all the way to Las Vegas. They entered this massive tournament. They're playing for two, like 8-10 hour days, maybe day three if they get to the whatever the end. But they're there because they love the game and they're having fun and they're creating memories and they're meeting new people and they're doing all these things. That is your game. Yeah. Let that be your game. Yes, there's always the pull and push on the balancing, and that should be a thing because people care about it and people want to play their cool toys and feel like they haven't lost before they get down. But there's a difference between that and it being like playing in the WNBA finals. Like there's such a vast gap there. Do not advertise one to me when the other is what really matters. And you know what? I'm also fine if they have this like super exclusive 16 people tournament by invite only of the highest placing people through the point system throughout the year. It's like these 16, there will be one world champion of Warhammer and they're going to walk away with a check with $10,000. That event does not skew the masses, right? Because it's just a small one of people that did really, really well and they won these big tournaments. Well, guess what? The people that win those big tournaments are the neckbeard tryhards that will put all the fucking sketchy ass Bolton boys or whatever the fuck it listed is in Song of Ice and Fire that you just put all that neutral unit in spam because it's broken.
Yeah. Golden Sword Company, I think you're talking about.
Yeah, so close.
Yeah. But no, you're right. And that is how TI works. There's a pro circuit that gets you points for events. Top eight teams in that list get in. Eight more teams get in through qualifiers, through these wild card events. And then you have 16 teams that then play for the grand finals.
Yeah.
So that could absolutely be a format for a legitimate world championship. Because you have the point system already. Someone's doing the work for you. So just leverage it.
Yeah. There was just like 3 weeks ago, there was a $100,000 Magic tournament. Wasn't even like world champs. Wasn't whatever.
Yeah.
It was a $100,000 cash prize.
Yeah.
Or it was total payout.
Yeah.
But like one of the streamers, YouTubers that I watch, he placed like, I don't remember what it was. It was like 20 something, 28th or whatever, something. And he still won like $8,000.
Yeah.
It was like, it was just a fucking 2-day Magic tournament.
Yeah, and some like third party organization set it up, something like that.
It's like my frustration with all of this is not to be misconstrued as me hating Games Workshop or hating Warhammer. It's kind of the opposite. I you're passionate about the things that frustrate you because you care about them, and one way or the other, I just want them to not pull the bait and switch on me. Commit to one thing, but if you're going to commit to that, and I'm like, commit to this World Championships of Warhammer, then actually commit to it.
Bro, they don't commit to anything. Space Marines are all things. They are good guys, they are bad guys, they are gray guys, okay? This is the company that does not commit.
Yeah, their history is vast and all-encompassing.
Yeah, their game is all things to all people, which obviously that's like a great business model.
It is literal shotgun approach.
Yeah, for sure. So the Games Workshop and Forge World website got merged into one big website. And I didn't know this was happening, but I showed up to the site on the day it was happening, and there was a wait time. So I...
wait time! Website?
Yeah, so I went to gamesworkshop.com and I got sent to q.warhammer.some insane token, and it was like, you have to wait for 7 minutes to get a 15-minute shopping session. And I just wanted to look at Necromunda warbands. That's all I wanted to do.
I want to look at pictures, bud.
That's all I look at pictures, literally.
Is there a button you can press? I just want to look at pictures.
There should be.
Ain't no one buying on this site. Who buys on the Warhammer official website?
There are people. Also, whenever you go to a Games Workshop store and they don't have a thing you want, the first thing the employee is taught is to get the person to buy it off of the web store. It comes to the store for free, no shipping, because they don't have everything in their catalog. So that maybe that's also a thing. But anyways.
What? They don't have everything in the catalog?
Oh, God, no.
What?
No way.
It's like you go to Apple Store and then like they just don't have the latest iPhone? Like,
well, I mean, the Apple's got 40 SKUs and GW's got like 7,000. So it's like a little bit harder, I think.
Sure.
But I thought you were going to push the sure button.
Random button.
Here's why you're wrong.
Got him.
So yeah, I think, sorry, I went to the website, I had to wait, I got in, it was working fine, it worked okay. I had a couple of issues where the website crashed after the 7-minute wait, and I had to fucking redo it.
Isn't that the whole point of the wait list, so it doesn't crash?
I don't even get the wait list in the first place. It's like, you had your website up and working for years, and it's like, do you think you're suddenly going to get more traffic now that you've just kind of changed the skin a little bit? It's like, no, dude. I didn't get that at all.
Dude, it's all that Forge World traffic. You know, when those lanes merge, that's 7 people that are on ForgeWorld.com.
See, that was something I didn't know going into it. I didn't know they had merged. So I was looking at Necromunda stuff, and I was like, man, look at all these sick one-off Necromunda characters. They're so awesome. And then I noticed it said 15 plus in the corner. And then I noticed it had a little label that said expert kit. And I was like, oh, is that how you talk about your shitty resin casting? It's like, you need to have a baseline of skill to deal with our bullshit.
You need to be a professional miniature painter.
No 14-year-olds allowed, bro. So yeah, then I realized, like, oh, they're combined together. Forge World and GW are now one website. So it was cool. It looks a little flashier. It's not like a huge difference. People were really hating on it, but maybe just after the couple first days of that queue bullshit, now it's fine. I shouldn't be in a queue anymore, right, Games Workshop?
Oh, let's do it live.
All right, we're going to go to...
Is it Warhammer.com?
I think it's that, or I'll try Games Workshop as well, see what happens.
Warhammer.com.
Yeah, now it changes to Warhammer.com, so it is that, and it works immediately. Okay, There's no queues.
I got to accept cookies. I got to put America's, USA, English...
So I have to check the box and then hit the X to get rid of the what nation am I in?
I guess.
That is...
There's no go button?
Yeah. Pushing the country should just get me out of that thing. But that's a usability thing.
Yeah, I'm not having to wait in line here. Everyone was so excited to... It's a nice mobile format.
Yeah. Hit shop here. Maybe that was the biggest change. They made it nicer for mobile. So now I'm like looking through the Age of Sigmar armies. It's a lot more straightforward.
I wonder if they used my Squarespace link to make this website.
Yeah, I would say it's definitely more mobile friendly. Just in this very brief anecdotal little test we just did.
A guy on the cover kind of looks like me.
Yeah. What?
Like, he kind of looks like me.
No, he fucking doesn't. What the fuck? No. What?
Okay, maybe he doesn't.
What? Hold on, why do you think that?
I don't know. He just
Hold on, now I need to look again.
His nose is very similar to mine.
Oh, maybe that's what it is. Okay, hold on. Now I feel like I need to give you time of day.
I mean, don't look at the fact. I mean, he's a different nationality, but just his facial structure is.
Yeah. I'm going to check. Okay, yeah, you're right.
If I go down like this, my face down like this.
No, now put your arm out. Yeah, this is your brother, right? The nose is right. You're right about the nose.
All right, Games Workshop, you used me for your pictures on your goddamn website.
This is an AI-modified version.
Let's check, count the number of fingers. How many fingers is he have?
All right, yeah, a lot of people were really angry. Even James says, and the new website is awful. It seems impossible, but it's somehow worse than before. Collapsing menus on websites are the enemy. Oh, maybe this is a PC thing. I can't remember. All right. I mean, a lot of people other than James also are having a lot of issue with the website. So it's not just him.
Okay. And the last one on here, I didn't look at it too closely, but
this was cool. My buddy sent me a link to this, though. If you do know, you know what Humble Bundles are, probably?
Humble Bundle is where you get the good deals for video games?
Yeah. So it goes towards charity, and you pay what you want, and you get just like an insane amount of video games, mostly on Steam. Mm-hmm. But this is a Humble Bundle for... STLs.
I better check this out.
161 miniatures started with $25 is like the recommended minimum donation. I don't know if you have to pay that. I can't remember.
It says pay $1 or more.
Yeah, so I think you can. I don't know. Maybe there are tiers that you can invest at. But
okay, we can do the math here because it says 3,416 sold, and this bundle has raised $8,175 for charity.
That doesn't seem right. Yeah,
it's like $2.50. Yeah. Average. Yes.
So you kind of, I mean, yeah. So that's pretty cool.
I like that they're doing something like this on Humble Bundle, or you know, just like diversifying the where you're getting STLs or anything like that.
Yeah, for sure. They've done like books in the past. They've done like Warhammer video games exclusively, or video games from a certain publisher like THQ or Bethesda.
Do you scroll through the models at all?
I have not. I don't need more STLs.
You're not missing out.
No.
I mean, there are some just at a glance, some that are promising. Like this one where this lady archer is riding a bear. Well, look at the bear. He's just like sit down. He's like, he's not having anything with it.
No. And like these dudes.
Yeah, those infantry guys are rough.
I don't know who did this.
You make 161 models. You're gonna
terrain. There's terrain. Though.
Okay, yeah, the terrain might be. Oh, look at the minecart shit.
Oh, there's dead bodies.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh man.
Oh, they're gonna get me. I gotta quit scrolling.
The terrain might be worth.
Oh yeah, the little crystals. You see the crystals?
No, show me the crystals.
I almost forgot the crystals.
Hey, those are nice.
Yeah, anytime little bitsy bits, terrain bits, that kind of thing, it just does it for me.
Yeah.
Just flexibility of putting it wherever I need to put it.
All right, that'll wrap up the news. Welcome to the end of the podcast. Thank you for hanging out all the way to the end. Listen to us hammer on about fucking Dota TI, Halloween candy, what competitive miniature wargaming looks like, etc., etc.
Yeah, it feels like we didn't talk about any particular thing, and yet we talked for so long.
Yeah. What were we at for recording time here? We're at 2 hours and 46 minutes, so that camera is about to run out of SD card space. So let's wrap it up.
Uh-oh.
If you like this podcast and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to do that. If you got some cash to spend, you can spend it on our Patreon, where you get access to an extended version of this podcast, about 20, 30 minutes longer. This podcast was about 30 minutes extra content.
Yeah.
You also get the opportunity to suggest topics. Like today, Scuba Steve gave us a topic.
Scuba Steve.
You also get the ability to submit a model to give feedback to. We did Dark Panzer today and his Horus Heresy era Blood Angels, we think.
It's his own reliquary chapter.
Yes. And so that is also another thing you get. Also, if you don't got $5, you can just do $1 a month. We have both of those options available to you. You can check out our merch store in the description as well. Teespring's got a lot of fun shirts, a lot of fun pants, a lot of fun cups. There's probably like what's the thing that you hit and candy comes out of it? Pinata. There should be a top pinata on there. I think Teespring does that by now, probably.
God, I hope so.
otherwise, if you don't got any cash to spend, you can just share our podcast with your friends. You can rate us wherever you're listening to podcasts, whether it's an audio version or a YouTube version. Leave a comment, leave a like. All that interaction helps out a lot.
We'll catch you in a fortnight, but until then, we'll see you on the
Lippity Flop.